The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it in the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now. Now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Pennsylvania State Senator Daylen Leach going to be talking about all of the radical right-wing attacks that are going on. Yesterday's the start of beating workers down, the start of pushing this no rights at work agenda. We're going to talk about that in the second hour. Our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson, is going to be here talking about some of the threshold bills that the Republicans are trying to ram through, taking us back to the good old days of cronyism and patronage. That whole oversight and transparency thing the Republicans love to talk about. Well, they're not so good on the follow through. And we're going to talk about that in the third hour. Professor Harvey Kay going to be here talking about his piece in the election that was yesterday in Wisconsin. I don't know if you paid attention to this, but we were here till late at night. And when I got home, I couldn't go to sleep. I had to, kept hitting the refresh on the tubes there to see the results as they came in. And it didn't finish up until, late this afternoon when the Democrat, Joanne Kloppenburg, declared that she's the victor. 204 vote margin. It's one of those things where you go, this is why I tell every person, every vote counts. Because at some point, those 204 people who voted for her had to make the choice of, do I cook dinner or do I go vote? Do I sit here and watch 15 more minutes of television or do I go cast my ballot? The right wants you to believe that, your vote doesn't matter. That doesn't count. You're just one person. What can you possibly do? In fact, they follow along the Paul Weyrich mentality. And I love this clip because it's their mentality in action. Paul Weyrich was the guy who pretty much founded the Heritage Foundation, this way out right wing conservative think tank in D.C. And in this, he's talking to a group of about 20,000 Southern ministers. And this is what his advice to the pulpit was.
Many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And conservatives understand that. They understand that as if they can keep the vote down, if they can suppress voters, if they can put up roadblocks like ID cards, and they can put up roadblocks like all kind of verification and written tests and all of that stuff of the past that we've gone through, all of that disenfranchisement that they love to throw up. If they can suppress the vote, they generally feel they can win. But if everybody gets out and votes and you have Because look here in the state of Pennsylvania. Democrats have a 1.2 million advantage in registered voters. Republicans understand that. So if they can suppress the vote, they're going to win. And, you know, I got to be honest. Democrats help them sometimes by doing dumb things. And I look what our president is doing right now. And I got to be honest, not happy with a lot of it. Statement from the AFL-CIO, their president, Rich Trumka, on the proposed Colombian Free Trade Agreement, which I guess, you know, now we're going to be moving forward on. Trumka says we are deeply disappointed that the Obama administration has signaled that it will move forward to submit the proposed U.S.-Colombia Free Trade Agreement to Congress for a vote in the near future. In our view, the situation in Colombia remains unacceptably violent for trade unionists as well as for human rights defenders and other vulnerable populations. In addition, Trumka says, Colombian workers face enormous and indefensible legal and practical hurdles in exercising their rights to organize unions and collectively bargain. He points out that union density in Colombia is below 5%, and even fewer workers can exercise their right to collective bargaining. He observes that we have no doubt that if 51 CEOs had been murdered in Colombia last year, because there are 51 trade unionists a year murdered in Colombia, if 51 CEOs were murdered in Colombia last year, this trade deal, he says, would be on a very slow track. He finishes up by saying, we are consulting closely with our union counterparts in Colombia, and will continue to consult with the Obama administration about the terms of the action plan and its implementation, but based on the information provided to us at this time, we remain strongly opposed to the Colombia trade agreement. Here's the thing. We can strongly oppose the Colombian trade agreement. We can strongly oppose the South Korean trade agreement. We can strongly oppose the Panamanian trade agreement. It's not going to make a hill of beans. It's not going to matter a bit. Because the working class of this country, we're never really concerned or considered in these agreements. Our hopes, our aspirations, our dreams, our thoughts, not in there. These agreements are artfully crafted by the highest priced legal minds in this country to benefit the very, very small, uber wealthy investors and to protect their interests. And it's interesting how Democrats don't seem to have a problem doing this. I mean, you go back, you look at trucking deregulation, one of my biggest knocks against Carter. He signed a lot of the deregulation that Reagan used to beat workers up with. You look at NAFTA was signed by Clinton and just full tilt boogie jobs leaving this country at an alarming rate. Obama's talking about opening up the Mexican border, allowing Mexican trucks to roll through, and now more of these job fleeing bills, because we're not actually fleeing the jobs anymore. We're allowing them to flee the country. We're allowing the jobs to be hemorrhaged. So these would be, I guess, job hemorrhaging trade agreements, because they're not going away. They're just going away from us. It's not going to die. It's just going to go somewhere else and live in somebody else's house. And what I found an interesting piece over at Salon by a guy named Glenn Greenwald, who I think is just a masterful writer. And it's worth looking at. He asks, how can the Democratic Party base itself possibly change the dynamic whereby politicians of the Democratic Party are not only willing but eager to kick them whenever possible, and that doing so is viewed as good politics? You look at what's going on right now. Colombia's coming up. Korea, they brought up. You know, Panama's not far behind. Obama has raced to the center, appointing corporatists to every position. He's now got his chief of staff, a former CEO. You've got his job czar, a guy who outsourced more jobs than anybody in the country. Somehow he's now the jobs are going to create jobs. Not sure where the jobs are supposed to be created. My guess is China. But, you know, here's the thing. We see these Democrats racing to the middle because politically we say, well, you know, and the Republicans love pushing this. because the further to the right Obama marches, just like Clinton, the further to the right he marched, you know, looking for that ideological center that just keeps moving further to the right, what happens is, you know, Boehner and the Republicans pick up the goalpost, move it further to the right. So what we've done is we've constantly marched, to where the Democratic Party doesn't seem to stand for many of the same values that I think we should be standing for, that they should be, which is why I'm saying, look, folks, you've got to get involved in your parties again. People got to take these over. Just like I say to the Republicans, your party has gone insane, and I don't have a problem with good, decent, American-loving Republicans. Take your party back. These guys are fascists. They're insane. But at some point, we've got to talk about moving things back to where you and I are the ones who are in charge, where our thoughts and our hopes and aspirations are considered. He writes, I submit that this is not only one of the most important domestic political questions, if not the most important, but also one that people are most eager to avoid engaging in. And the reason is that there are no comfortable answers. And he's right. There are no comfortable answers. There are no easy answers here. And he says one thing is for certain right now, the Democratic Party is absolutely correct in its assessment that kicking its base is good politics. Why is that? He writes, because they know that they have inculcated their base with sufficient levels of fear and hatred of the GOP so that no matter how often the party kicks them, no matter how often the party leaders break their promise and betray their values, the base will be loyal and dutiful. And, you know, I look at the situation that Trump is in. Labor has been tied. Its horse is tied to the Democratic Party. Why? Because the Republicans have been the ones who have harmed labor the most. So there's nowhere else to go right now. Which is why I don't want anyone endorsing the president. He's announced he's running. I'm not putting on that I'm on board. He's going to have to win my vote again, just like I think every labor person in this country should be saying. There's nothing automatic here. I'm even in favor of beginning to look at maybe running a challenger in the primary, because at the end of this, if you're not going to do the things that that are going to help us, we're guaranteeing ourselves irrelevance. We're guaranteeing that our needs are never going to be met. You know, when I looked to this president, there were some things that I expected from him when he ran last time. There was some stuff on my agenda that said, you know what, this is the reason I'm voting for this guy, because I think he gets it. Where's the Employee Free Choice Act, one of the centerpieces of his campaign? Where's labor law reform? When are we going to end the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? When are we going to reform the Patriot Act? You know, I thought we were close to closing Guantanamo Bay. What happened to health care for everybody? And above all, where are those rational trade policies that we so desperately needed? Where are those trade policies that he said he was, you know, America first? Colombia is definitely not one of those, and we're going to talk about that tonight. We're going to talk about a bunch of stuff. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What are your thoughts? Are you as upset about this as I am? These trade agreements, and it's going to be interesting to see where the T-twits are. It's going to be really interesting to see where the T-twizzlers are on this, because they ran on this America First agenda where we're not going to have any more of these trade deals that ship jobs out of the countries, because that's one of the things that I agreed with the Tea Party on. And that's where I think there's a chance to reach out and draw some consensus in this nation. My thoughts, anyway. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Pennsylvania State Senator Dalen Leach, we're back after this.
Rick
Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
AFSCME President Gerald McEntee says the Republican budget plan cutting $6 trillion over 10 years by gutting Medicare and Medicaid is a disaster for working people. The Service Employees International Union President, Mary Kay Henry, says it's an all-out assault on children, seniors, and the disabled. The Center for American Progress's Pat Garofalo says that Representative Paul Ryan's GOP budget plan destroys Medicare and Medicaid as we know them and repeals the Affordable Health Care Act. Garofalo says if budgets are moral documents, this is the Republican morality writ large.
This says morally that the government does not have an obligation to care for the poor, the old. It doesn't have an obligation to educate and create a 21st century workforce because it cuts Pell Grants to the bone. It basically says that the, you know, those who are well off will continue to be well off and not have to, you know, pay to support the society that helped them get well off. They don't think we have a responsibility to take care of seniors. They don't think we have a responsibility to take care of the poor. They're willing to raise taxes on the middle class in order to cut them for the rich. And when they want to implement budget cuts, the only budget items they look at are the ones that help people in the middle class and on the lower end of the income scale. It's gutting the social safety net, throwing tax breaks to the rich and corporations, and hoping that everything shakes out in the end.
On April 4th, 2011, while hundreds of rallies, marches, and vigils were taking place throughout the country in memory of Dr. Martin Luther King, one of the men that stood by his side the day he was assassinated was in Madison, Wisconsin, addressing an audience of nearly 10,000. Jackson and King were in Memphis that week to march in solidarity with striking sanitation workers. Two of those Memphis sanitation workers stood side by side with Jackson in Wisconsin. Jackson said there's no room for the current disparity gripping the United States in a democracy as envisioned by King. He said the best way to honor the civil rights activist's memory is by following his mantra of keep hope alive.
It is freedom time, it is hell time, it is Martin Luther King time. Keep hope alive. Go on.
Winds Jesse Russell reporting from Madison. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals, and by the National Association of Letter Carriers.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And now, back to a man who's never seen a $20,000 shower curtain, Rick Smith.
I'm too sexy for my shirt. Too sexy for my shirt. So sexy. It hurts, and I am too sexy for Milan, too sexy for Milan, New York and Japan.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. Earlier today, the Pennsylvania chapter of the National Association of Social Workers took to the Capitol to rally for school social workers and for practice protection and workforce standards. A couple of Republican-backed bills who have gotten some bipartisan support, Senate Bill 912 and 922, I guess are going to do some of the things that these folks would like. One of the people at the rally is our next guest, Senator Daylon Leach. He told them, gave them credit for their activism and energy, and told them, well, we're going to need it. Senator Leach, thanks for being here.
Good to be with you, Rick.
You know, I'm looking at all of the activity going around. People come to the Capitol. You know, and speaking out against the budget, against this no rights at work agenda, a whole bunch of stuff.
Well, it was a very busy week. Actually the social workers rally was huge. There was a terrific turnout. And when I said we're going to need their activism and their energy, what I meant was, I'm very appreciative. I think it's a great bill. I'm very appreciative of Senator McElhaney for introducing it. I would note though that it's ironic, considering that His caucus is actually going the opposite direction in the Education Committee this week, where they voted to move through a bill which would say that school nurses no longer have to be certified because it's, quote, you know, it's cheaper to hire people who are not properly trained. and it was part of what they call mandate relief. So, you know, this is a mandate. The social requiring sort of the social workers work with kids to be, you know, properly trained and certified is a mandate. You know, some mandates are good, but mandates is another word for rules.
Right.
And it's good to have rules. But you know, their caucus seems to be bent on repealing all the rules, at least all the rules that benefit you know, the kids in public schools. So I hope they move this bill. And I'm fully in support of it. I would say that it would be, it's seemingly inconsistent with the rest of what they're trying to do this term.
Yeah, I again, you know, it's this whole agenda that I see coming before us. The same kind of things that are going on in Wisconsin and Ohio, only to a lesser degree, this agenda of no rights at work. You know, yesterday we saw Representative Metcalf come out with his right to work bill, which I think is just an absolute slap in the face to every working person in this state, but I guess we're going to have this argument.
Well, yeah, and this is a movement that's been around a long time. I used to debate this issue 20 years ago around the state. You know, the fact is, what I get a kick out of is that the guys like Metcalf who push, quote, right-to-work legislation always try to make it sound like they're doing a favor for workers. You know, we're gonna push through legislation that will result in you having lower wages, fewer benefits, and poorer working conditions. Please, no need to thank us. I mean, you know, when someone who has no history of being on the side of workers starts talking about how they're doing workers a favor, you really have to be skeptical.
Well, you look at the groups that he brought in with him.
Yeah.
None of them actually represent people. They represent corporations.
Oh, sure. And they're upset because, you know, the fact is that if you're in a union versus not being in a union in the same job, you're going to make more money, you're going to have better benefits, you're going to have better working conditions, and you're going to have people behind you. And, you know, corporations don't like that. They like to have an individual worker in there. They like to say, look, this is going to be your wages, this is going to be your benefits, if any, and take it or leave it. And they know with the union, you can't do that. You have to bargain with everyone at once. And they don't like that. They, workers getting a decent wage and getting good benefits is simply not how the world's supposed to work, according to a lot of the people on stage with Daryl Metcalf yesterday.
Yeah, I got to be honest. I was just floored by some of the rationale, some of the talking points that they had. And I left there going, if these are the people who are going to be out there making their pitch, I don't know that I'm all that concerned. Although Republicans do control every branch and pretty sizably.
Yes, they do, and. You know, if they want to push this sort of thing through, they can. I mean, we're even in a worse position than Wisconsin because if we left the state, it wouldn't matter. A quorum is a majority in Pennsylvania, so anything they have the votes to pass, they have the votes to have a quorum for. Although we did see, as you know, some very good news in Wisconsin yesterday. So, it shows that when we wake people up and they finally realize what's at stake, they become very active very quickly.
And that's what I'm seeing with a lot of my friends who, you know, my union member friends who for the longest time thought that because they were making a solid middle class living that somehow that they were Republican candidates. They're now waking up to the reality that can be ripped away from them at any minute.
Oh, sure. And what they're also seeing is, you know, and frankly, I've got, you know, as a liberal, I get very frustrated with my fellow liberals sometimes because, you know, I remember during the 2010 campaign, you know, friends of mine were saying to me, you know, essentially, we're not living in a utopia yet. We've been in control for 2 years and, you know, we haven't solved all the problems of the world. We don't have single payer. We don't have card check. So why bother voting? And you know, I always quote Joe Biden, a great quote, which is, you know, don't compare me to the Almighty, compare me to the alternative. But we didn't do that last time. We were just, you know, we got complacent, I think. And the thing about Republicans is when they actually get in power, they really, you know, they really believe this stuff and they really push it. And we realize how extreme their agenda is. Unfortunately, we're going to have to ride this wave for at least the next 2 years. Until we have an opportunity to inject a little more sanity into the process.
Well, and talking about sanity in the process, there has to be some sane voices on this budget that our this governor has proposed. $1 billion cut to education K through 12, 56% cut to higher education. At some point, some rational thought has to come into this. And I saw yesterday, the Republicans said, well, you know, maybe we'll take some money from over there, from public welfare, which you knew they were going to do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is, you know, keep in mind, first let me say this, that the cuts to higher education speak for themselves. They're just, it's not really cuts. It's a complete abandonment of the idea of state-supported higher education in Pennsylvania. But it's even worse. If anything, you understated the problem in terms of K through 12. Not only do they want to take, you know, $1 billion away from that, which we, you know, we're underfunding it by about $4 billion now. They want to take $1 billion more away from it. Then they want to pass the voucher bill, which will take away another $1 billion or so from public education, particularly the poorest schools. And then they want to pass legislation that says you need 2/3 of a vote at the school board level to even try to make up some of that revenue locally. And even if you get that 2/3 of the vote, they want to pass another bill that says you can never raise property taxes more than the rate of inflation, which is about 1.4% this year, even though the school district, the things school districts pay for, go up at a rate higher than the rate of general inflation. So it's like a four-pronged direct assault on the idea that we should have decent schools in Pennsylvania. It's absolutely awful. So, of course, the Republicans, rather than saying, you know what, we need some more revenues, which is what any family would do, which is what any business would do.
That's what I've been saying.
They say, you know, I mean, Corbett's essentially said, if we find money on the ground, or if some billionaire gives us a gift, we're not going to spend that money. He said, under no circumstances will I sign a budget over $27.3 billion. And so, you know, we can play around. You can say, okay, the cuts in school are too much. Let's make some cuts out of poor people instead. But it's all bad, and you know, they successfully pitted, you know, various constituencies against each other rather than fighting for what would help everybody, which is more revenues to be able to provide a decent education and provide a reasonable safety net.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, poll after poll, I'm seeing people are saying, look, we want to tax the drillers. We want to close the Delaware loophole. We think corporations should pay their fair share. And to be honest, the way I see it, the drillers, they want to pay the tax. They're already charging it for us. They don't want all this bad PR.
Yeah, I speak to the drillers and their representatives all the time. You're absolutely right, Rick. They're like, we fully expected. We pay the tax in every other state. We fully expected to pay the tax here. They're sort of, you know, surprised and shocked that no one's asking them to pay anything for the resources they're taking out of our ground. You know, Sarah Palin has an energy tax. Governor Perry in Texas has an energy tax. These are not flaming liberals. I mean, every other state has it. Pennsylvanians would not pay the tax because, you know, this product is not sold in Pennsylvania. It's sold worldwide on commodities markets. They can't raise the price because we've raised the tax. And so, you know, there's really no rational reason. I mean, this is nothing but an ideological, theological almost reflex. There's no rational reason why we wouldn't take the $400 to $500 billion we could have next year, which would offset half of the education cuts right there. Even before we get to the Delaware loophole, even before we consider not being the only state in the nation that doesn't tax smokeless tobacco, you know, we could do a lot of things to resolve this situation if we just didn't have this extreme ideology overlaying everything we tried to do.
You know, they say that budgets are about, you know, it's a moral document. It shows what your priorities are. And I look at this and I have to question the priorities of this governor and the vision, if he has a vision of what tomorrow is going to bring us. I understand short-term cuts for today, but what about tomorrow?
You know, you make an excellent point. Because as awful as this budget is, we're not done. You know, I mean, next year, you know, I mean, when we cut 50-some percent from higher education, and we need to, you know, because we do not want any more revenues, so we need to cut a whole bunch more money next year, where's that going to come from? Keep in mind, we can't cut much of the budget, even if we wanted to, because of federal law, because of state law, and because of contracts. So you know, the percentage of the budget we can cut, the things we can cut, we keep going back to over and over and over again. Let me just say, like, higher education, you know, huge cut this year they're proposing. It's not like, you know, the gravy train was flowing the last few years. Penn State has not received a dollar increase in their subsidy in 10 years. Okay? Now, I want to talk about adjusted for inflation. I mean, in real dollars, it's exactly the same as it was 10 years ago, despite the fact that inflation has gone up about 30% since then. So we've already had a 30% cut in education. This year, they want a 52.4% cut in Penn State. How much more do they want next year? At some point, even they would have to say there really is no such thing as a state school anymore in Pennsylvania.
Well, isn't the whole point, going back to their theology of privatize, selling off state assets at you know, and this is basically just cutting them off the die.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's privatized and abandoned because, you know, keep in mind, once you privatize something, there, you know, the free market operates on a profit basis, which it should, and that's fine. But it's very hard to make a profit off of, for example, giving health care to someone with no money or to educating a child who doesn't have any money. Okay? It's hard to make a profit doing those things. That's why the government has been involved historically. When the government abandons that role, it's not like those kids have a plan B. It's not like those sick people have a plan B. It's not like people who need legal services have a plan B. They're just abandoned, and that is the philosophy that's governing us now.
That's an excellent point, Senator Leach. You know, I talked to a guy when the college students were in Harrisburg for their rally. He said, look, you know, my grandfather worked at this factory. My father up until 10 years ago worked at this particular factory. If I don't graduate from college and be the first in my family to be able to do that, there's no factory for me to go back to.
Yep, absolutely. And then what is there to go back to? And, of course, when someone's unemployed a long time and they go on public assistance, you know, that's the next huge cut that's coming. And it's not just, you know, keep in mind, when people say, well, we're going to cut welfare, people imagine, you know, what Ronald Reagan used to call the gas-guzzling, the vodka-swilling, Cadillac-owning welfare queen. Of course, you know, such a person rarely, if ever, exists. But put that aside, that's not what the welfare department pays for now, typically. It pays for long-term care, nursing home care for people who don't have any other financial options. What do we do with those people if we cut it, you know, 30-40%? Where do those people go? People with no families who are in state nursing homes, where would they go? I mean, you know, you ask them these questions, they just look at you blankly. We have to decide if we want a society where they're just sort of dumped on the street or what. I don't know.
Well, I guess we do. I mean, a couple years ago, if you remember, Kaiser Permanente in California were actually taking indigent patients and putting them in cabs and dropping them on Skid Row.
Yep. That's
that's conservative world right there.
You're absolutely right, and that's what we've got to stop that. We've got to fight that, and we've got to put aside sort of the petty differences that make us less effective, and B, we've got to put aside, and liberals are terrible at this, we whenever we get any modicum of power, we expect perfection from the people we elect. You know, perfection is very difficult to come by in politics, I have learned. And you can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, and you have to realize that incremental progress is better than dramatic, regress. And you know, the conservatives are very good at this. I mean, they have been historically. I don't know if they will be this time. The Tea Party seems to be in sort of a, you know, if you compromise a tiny bit, then we're done with you mode, which we have been in at various points in our history on the left side of the spectrum. So we'll see what that, but historically, in the last 30 years, Republicans have been very good at putting aside their differences, keeping their eye on the ball. We need to be better at that.
Yeah, well, the moneyed people usually keep them in line.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we don't really have moneyed people. We don't have the Koch brothers, you know, we're sort of a more loosely affiliated ragtag organization, but, you know, we've got to get smart, and, You know, we've got to understand. I mean, I'll tell you, I spoke to some friends of mine last night who are like, geez, you know, Obama's done some good things, but he hasn't done A, B, and C. It's going to be hard to get excited about voting for him in 2012. And I was like, are you out of your mind?
Well, I got to be honest with you, Senator. And this is where I, just a minute ago, I've been railing on about the Colombian Free Trade Agreement because I'm absolutely infuriated by this, along with a whole other litany of things that haven't been even addressed, not even in an attempt. Now, I'm not saying, you know, as you've said, you know, he's not the almighty. He's better than the alternative. But at some point, you've got to be able to push him in the right direction and put some pressure there, I think. Or am I wrong?
I agree. And I support pushing him. I myself, when I tweet and when I Facebook, when I write my blog, you know, I have frequently, I mean, there have been issues on which I've been frustrated, and that would be true of any president except me. You know, the only president I wouldn't be frustrated with constantly is probably myself, and probably everyone else would be. So, sure. I mean, during the health care, why didn't we push harder for this? Why did we compromise on this? Why? You know, on card check, maybe we couldn't have gotten card check, but we probably could have gotten this, that, and the other thing. So, I agree with you. There's certainly, you know, he's not the almighty. He's made mistakes. They all make mistakes, but, I think his heart's in the right place. I think on most issues, he's moving us forward. And there's a great website about what Obama has done, you know, again, if you're unhappy with anything that he's done from the perspective of a liberal, just imagine what your state of mind would be if we have President Romney next time or President Haley Barbour. You'd be much, much more unhappy. I mean, we should work our butts off for Obama for no other reason than just Supreme Court appointees. I mean, you look at the vote, Sotomayor and Elena Kagan versus the votes of Alito and Scalia and Roberts. And you're like, you know, that affects every issue. Who should be appointing these judges? And you see how important that is.
You make excellent arguments, but at the end of the day, we still need to push him in the right direction. Last question I've got for you. As all of this stuff comes piling down upon us, because the attacks have started and they're going to come fast and furious, what do average people, what do our listeners do? What do we need to do to help stop some of this insanity?
Well, first of all, it's important to be informed. As Bob Dylan said, know your song well before you start singing. So learn about these issues. And then you got to be able to communicate. You got to be able to frame issues in ways that people understand. You know, the Republicans always talk about we've got to help the job creators. They don't say we have to help the rich, okay? But that's what they mean. We got to help rich people because, hell, they give us money for our campaigns, and we are rich people, lots of them, if you look at the senators in the U.S. Senate, for example, Republican senators. But, they talk about the job creators. We got to talk about the job doers. We have to frame issues in a way that the average person understands. Too often we have been, you know, they give us a bumper sticker, we give them a book. And people don't read the book, and the bumper sticker prevails. We've got to be able to communicate clearly, crisply, and intelligently, and knowledgeably and aggressively. It's a battle of ideas. We've got to use all the weapons.
Excellent. Excellent advice. Senator Dalen Leach, I appreciate your time. Would love to have you back again soon.
Anytime, Rick. Thanks.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
week in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
They're back. Actually, they never left. They just laid low while the heat of political anger blew over. They are the schemers and scammers of Wall Street, who devised the phantasmagoric money-from-nothing good times machine that was fueled by indecipherable derivatives and other financial fairy dust. If you're presently stuck in hard economic times, you have them to thank, for it was their hocus-pocus that, poof, imploded our economy in 2008. Responding to public outrage, President Obama and the Democratic Congress passed a reform bill last year that tightened the rules on these tricksters. But now, with Wall Street hugging Republicans running the House and Obama himself turning Wall Street friendly, the schemers and scammers are demanding that Washington loosen those pesky rules so they can restart that good times machine for their own fun and profit. For example, the biggest banks are pressing hard for the Treasury Department to exempt a derivatives game called foreign exchange swaps from any regulation. These gambles on the ups and downs of foreign currencies are not only risky, they're massive, with some $4 trillion being bet on them every day. A hiccup in this speculative game can ruin the day of a whole country. But a handful of Wall Street giants rake in about $9 billion a year handling these high-rolling bets, and they don't want the public even seeing what they're doing. Don't regulate us, they say. Trust us. They assert that the currency game is the one derivatives market that did not crash in 2008. This is Jim Hightower saying, not so fast, Slick. The only reason it did not crash is that the Federal Reserve poured more than $5 trillion into foreign central banks that year to prop it up. To keep up with these tricksters, check out Americans for Financial Reform. They're at www.ourfinancialsecurity.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You know, that's what we're going to start doing here. Start hawking things. So, open up your coat. I got watches. Yeah, we got staplers for sale. It's infuriating on so many levels. Let's quick go to the phones. We got James on line one. How are we doing tonight, James?
Pretty good. First of all, I seem to remember a while back somebody suggesting a progressive challenge to Obama, but I can't remember who it was.
That was probably you.
Okay, but also, I just wanted to give you a heads up while I was waiting for... Actually, I was kind of working on something. You'll like it. It's kind of a... using a little program I found on YouTube that actually echoes a lot of what you talked about, what you've been talking about for the last 45 minutes. That's all I'm going to say. But also, while I was hanging around, WITF Smart Talk had the... I think his name is Bob Edgar.
Uh-huh.
From Common Cause. And let's just say that I think we may have found in Common Cause, I know they've kind of been laying low for a couple of years. Not anymore. As I said, they put up the information about the Smart Talk on your Facebook page. So you might want to check that out when you get a spare moment.
I will most certainly do. If I'm not mistaken, I think we've had someone from Common Cause on. We talked with Alex Kaplan a couple of times from there about the drilling and all the money that went to Corbett. They were doing some really good work on the campaign, on all the money that Tom Corbett was taking to fill his campaign coffers. Appreciate the call, James.
Bye-bye.
Always great talking to you.
All right, bye.
At the end of all of this, you know, and I go back to this and look. I'm blowing off a lot of steam. The reality is Obama understands. He's it. We're going to live or die on what he does, because truth be told, labor is not going to back a Republican. Working people should not be looking to the Republican Party as their savior, because they're not. They're the ones who put you in this mess. They're the ones who've encouraged more job outsourcing, deregulation, more control by the uber wealthy, by the Much like Dalen said, you know, the people that they call job creators. Yeah, what I'm saying is they create those jobs overseas, not like Jeffrey Eimelt, the guy from GE. So, you know, at the end of this, it's really infuriating. And what it calls to us to do is to get active and to push this president, even if we have to run a primary challenger, which I don't think is going to amount to much. I don't think you're going to do much with that, but something. You got to do something in a symbolic nature, I think. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Right back after this.
Listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Our workers' comp system is a confusing maze of rules, delays, and loopholes, where workers struggle to collect what they are owed. Bills don't get paid, and families struggle to put food on the table after a serious work injury. What happens when you're injured on the job in Pennsylvania? Most people think you just apply for workers' comp, and you'll get paid for lost time, and your medical bills will be covered. Sadly, in Pennsylvania, that is not the case. The good news is, it doesn't have to be that way. Hi, I'm Ron Calhoun, and I'm a Central Pennsylvania workers' compensation attorney. It's my job to make sure injured workers receive the benefits they deserve. In the last 20 years, I have helped hundreds of Pennsylvania workers and their families after they've suffered from a work injury. If you've been injured on the job, I'd like the chance to show you how I might be able to do the same for you. Why not find out what you're rightfully owed? Call me at 717-695-4722. You have nothing to lose and much to gain. Call me at 695-4722.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy!
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Well, you know, here's the thing. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This Colombian Free Trade Agreement. Ron Kirk, the U.S. Trade Representative, said in a conference call today that the President will now begin working with lawmakers to get this Colombian Trade Accord approved, along with South Korea, along with Panama, the whole the trifecta there, which I'm saying is going to cost us jobs. I don't see how it's going to bring us anything. You look at NAFTA, you look at a lot of the other ones, we've lost jobs over these. But what we've been able to do is we've been able to enrich the big corporations. We've been able to enrich the few at the expense of the many. And that's what these are about. Look, Colombia, the main reason that you're seeing a big pushback is that labor understands this is imaging. This is the message that Reagan sent during the 80s that shot heard across the boardroom when he fired the Patco workers. This is that major slap in the face moment, because all we've been hearing is, well, we need to be more business friendly. And what could be more business friendly than taking trade unionists up in a plane and throwing them out? What could be more business friendly than having less than 5% unionization? What could be more business friendly than having workers who are scared to death that they're going to get pulled off of a bus and shot in the head in front of their coworkers? How much more business friendly do we need to be? Because that's what this is telling us. This is the message that's being sent. And people go, well, you know, you shouldn't be upset with Obama. Well, I'm really upset about. Now, they're touting the fact that they've made some strides forward. You know, we've made Colombia, you know, agree to do some things. You know, they've agreed to accelerate their effective date. This is from their document. Accelerate their effective date from July 13th to June 11th for legal provisions, including significant fines to prohibit the misuse of cooperatives and other employment relations that undermine workers' rights. You know what? That's a great thing. They're not going to do it because we don't do it. Good luck on that. Why don't we start with these labor law reforms at home? Another one is they want regulations by June 15th that implement the 2010 cooperatives law, clarify early cooperatives laws, and ensure coherence among these laws. The regulations will include significant fines for companies that violate cooperative laws and refuse to create and maintain direct employment relations with affected workers. Again, you know, you kind of look, point the finger at somebody else. Do we do it? Not so much. They want to double, Columbia's agreed to, doubling the number of labor inspectors. They're going to have to hire a bunch more over the next couple of years. Maybe we should talk about hiring some labor inspectors. They want to dedicate 100 labor inspectors to exclusively address abuse of cooperatives to deny workers' rights. Maybe we should consider doing that ourselves. They want preventative inspections that will begin immediately in the palm oil, sugar mines, and ports, flowers, and all those industries. They want to conduct outreach programs to inform workers of their rights. You know what? I got a good idea. Why don't we try that here? Why don't we try, implementing some of the ILO measures. You know, like the right to collective bargaining, the right to join and form a union, instead of having corporate tools like Metcalf saying, well, we want Pennsylvania to be number 23 right to work state. Or that idiot out in Wisconsin saying, well, we want to take collective bargaining away. Or the guy in Ohio who said, we want to take it away from everybody. You know, at some point, you can't tell others to do things that we're not doing. And I look at this trade agreement for working people is horrible. You know who it's good for? Good for the Chamber of Commerce. The president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, or as I affectionately call them, the GOP hit squad, their president, Tom Donahue, said, this proves the United States can still lead on trade. That's right. We can still lead our jobs out of the country. The CEO of Caterpillar, sees Colombia as one of the biggest export countries that they can go to. The CEO says, not only is Colombia one of Caterpillar's 10 largest export markets by country, but it's also one of America's closest allies. And it's good for business. Colombia is a validation that Colombia is a good place to conduct business. You know why? Because all those pesky union people, we could take them up in planes, throw them out. That's just how I see it. And my problem is this president who courted labor like none other, courted working people like none other, I think has forgotten and needs to be reminded. Because, look, I still think he's a good guy. I still think maybe he's got a vision going forward. But at the end of this, I think he's taking some bad advice here, Jake. I just look at this and it's infuriating.
Well, and what is really even more infuriating, they're trying to cover their tracks here by saying, well, we negotiated a special action plan which addresses the Colombian government's lack of going after the people who killed these unionists, and that's the fear. Prior to this, I think the number 4%, I believe there are about 4% of the murders, someone was held accountable. The rest, no. Nobody was ever found. Why? Because the people who murder are well-connected. They're well-heeled. They're protected by the power structure. And they're still protected by the power structure. You can have all the agreements you want, Rick. But until you have fundamental change in the country, which they still don't have, you're still going to have murders occurring with impunity. By the way, in other areas, this agreement, according to the AFL-CIO, falls far short of international standards. In other words, it's business as usual. Just put a few, dress up a pig. You dress up a pig, put a dress on, it's still a pig. And in the end, this agreement is going to hurt the workers in both countries.
U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown and Mark Kirk, Republican of Illinois, today announced the introduction of a bipartisan piece of legislation, the National Manufacturing Strategy Act of 2011. This legislation is aimed at bolstering the competitiveness of American manufacturing. Look, at the end of this, all of these trade agreements, we can do all of these bizarre trade agreements. If we cannot keep jobs in this country, if we cannot grow a manufacturing base, if we can't keep jobs here, we can't exist. If we cannot produce things, we are not going to be a superpower. We can bomb, we can do all of those things, we can have war all the time, but if you're not producing your war machine, kind of going to be hard to continue that practice. And the more I look at these, trade agreements, the more worried I get. Republican Senator Mark Kirk said manufacturing is the backbone of the U.S. economy. Today, American manufacturing has fallen behind China as the world's leading producer. This bill will establish the relationship, the national roadmap to spur economic growth, create new jobs, and keep U.S. Competitive in the global market. Yet at the same time, we're talking about opening up more avenues for jobs to leave. Maybe I'm wrong here, but when you look at the massive trade deficit we have with the rest of the world, don't you at some point have to look at that and say that is a serious problem, and that is part and parcel of why we have such a massive deficit? I just go back to this Columbia thing, Jake, and I'm stuck on the idea that this is another one of those moments that the boardroom is going to get this message that, you know what, Obama really is business friendly, and we're going to have a business friendly government, and you know, I guess the message is it's okay to do those things, it's okay, to suppress workers. Now, I'm not saying that they're going to be able to throw union members out of planes here. No. They're much more civilized here. They're just going to take your job away and starve you to death.
Well, I go back to the statement by President Clinton, who said, there's plenty of money in this country. I think he said the banks have $2 trillion and big business has another trillion. Could this be a situation where Obama, of the mindset, I'm not saying it is or isn't, I'm just throwing this out to you, to say, well, you know, if we appease them, work with them a little bit, maybe they'll start spending their money in this country. Now, first of all, I think that's a supposition that may or may not be true, even if they get what they want. But beyond that, I see no intention of them spending their money as of now, unless it enriches them. They don't care. They don't seem to care about the future of this country.
Not at all. Anyway, let's take a quick break. We're right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people come to talk. We're back with Irwin Aronson.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
AFSCME President Gerald McEntee says the Republican budget plan cutting $6 trillion over 10 years by gutting Medicare and Medicaid is a disaster for working people. The Service Employees International Union President Mary Kay Henry says it's an all-out assault on children, seniors, and the disabled. The Center for American Progress's Pat Garofalo says that Representative Paul Ryan's GOP budget plan destroys Medicare and Medicaid as we know them and repeals the Affordable Health Care Act. Garofalo says if budgets are moral documents, this is the Republican morality writ large.
This says morally that the government does not have an obligation to care for the poor, the old. It doesn't have an obligation to educate and create a 21st century workforce because it cuts Pell Grants to the bone. It basically says that the, you know, those who are well off will continue to be well off and not have to, you know, pay to support the society that helped them get well off. They don't think we have a responsibility to take care of seniors. They don't think we have a responsibility to take care of the poor. They're willing to raise taxes on the middle class in order to cut them for the rich. And when they want to implement budget cuts, the only budget items they look at are the ones that help people in the middle class and on the lower end of the income scale. It's gutting the social safety net, throwing tax breaks to the rich and corporations, and hoping that everything shakes out in the end.
On April 4th, 2011, while hundreds of rallies, marches, and vigils were taking place throughout the country in memory of Dr. Martin Luther King, one of the men that stood by his side the day he was assassinated was in Madison, Wisconsin, addressing an audience of nearly 10,000. Jackson and King were in Memphis that week to march in solidarity with striking sanitation workers. Two of those Memphis sanitation workers stood side by side with Jackson in Wisconsin. Jackson said there's no room for the current disparity gripping the United States in a democracy as envisioned by King. He said the best way to honor the civil rights activist's memory is by following his mantra of keep hope alive.
It is dream time, it is hell time, it is Father's Day time. Keep hope alive. Go, 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 go.
WIN's Jesse Russell reporting from Madison. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals, and by the National Association of Letter Carriers.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can go there and download our podcast there for your entertainment, your enjoyment, convenience. And if you want to email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. You know, I remember, you know, the back in 2008 when the president was running and he came to the convention in Philadelphia that the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO had, and he said quite frankly on this Colombian Free Trade Agreement, he said he'll oppose the Colombian Free Trade Agreement if Bush insists on sending it to Congress because the violence against unions in Colombia would make a mockery of the very labor protections that we have insisted be included in these kind of agreements. He said, you can trust me when I say that whatever trade deals we negotiate when I'm president will be good for American workers and that they'll have strong labor and environmental protections that we'll enforce. I was sitting there not more than 20 feet from him when he said that. And I look at this Columbia deal and I'm just not seeing it. Not at all. Anyway, we're going to talk to our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Irwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, good to be here. How you doing?
I'm kind of upset tonight. Kind of angry about this Colombian Free Trade Agreement.
Well, stand in line. You are a member of a long line of people who have been very upset about these hocus-pocus free trade agreements going back to NAFTA and before. The issue when we were opposing NAFTA in the Clinton administration was reasonable labor and environmental protections. Here we are all these years later, and the issue in this hocus-pocus Colombia Free Trade Agreement that you're absolutely right, President Obama, when he was candidate Obama, said would not happen under his watch, are labor protections and environmental protections.
Yep, and you know, he said, you can trust me. You can trust me when I say Whatever deal we negotiate when I'm president will be good for American workers. I'm not seeing it. What I'm saying is, what this is, this could be one of those moments heard across the boardroom, much like the firing of the Patco workers, where CEOs go, you know what? Maybe he's on board with this business friendly thing. Because what could be more business friendly than taking trade unionists up in planes and pitching them out?
Well, it's hard to imagine, but that's exactly what the issue is in Colombia. That was the holdup for all these years, was this insane, cannibalistic almost, penchant that the Colombian government had for literally murdering trade unionists for the crime of being a union member.
Well, let's talk about insane and going after union people. We don't have to go far. Just across the street here at the Capitol here in Harrisburg, yesterday, Metcalf, his corporate cabal, unfurled their attack with their no rights at work agenda, euphemistically called right to work. Curious what your thoughts on that are.
I'm dumbfounded. Not that an ideologue like Metcalf would put this stuff forward, but that people have the colossal gall to give him attention and ink and airtime on such a far-out loony bird concept. Everybody knows that in the so-called right-to-work states, which are really right-to-wreck states, everything is supposed to be up is down, and everything is supposed to be down is up. Infant mortality is up. Education is down. Wages are down. Bankruptcies are up. We know this. It's statistically proven not just recently, but in every year and every decade since 1947, when the Taft-Hartley Act was passed nationally, that gave some states the right to adopt these phony bills. Right to work confers no right, as you know, on anybody, and I think you describe it very well when you say no rights at work, because what it is an effort by which to strip people of a voice at the workplace. Metcalf needs to get a message that he ain't Scott Walker, and this ain't Scott.
Absolutely. You know, as a labor attorney, you know, one of the things that I'd like you to talk a bit about, because I don't think most people understand that without a contract, this is an at-will state, which means what?
It means you can be discharged or disciplined, but significantly discharged for just cause, unjust cause, or no cause at all. It means that the difference between you in 2011 and a slave in Georgia in 1864 is the amount they choose to pay you this week and nothing much more. The only restriction on an employer in Pennsylvania or any other employment at will state exists when there's a contract of employment or, more significantly, a collective bargaining agreement. Beyond that, there are some minor restrictions. People don't really understand here that in the United States, discrimination generally is perfectly legal. There are only a handful of types of discrimination that are legally prohibited at the workplace. One is on the basis of race, one is on the basis of gender, one is on the basis of age for people over 40, and one is on the basis of disability, but only if the employer is able to make a so-called reasonable accommodation to the disability. Any other form of discrimination in this country at the workplace is perfectly legal, not prohibited, not governed, not looked at, not overseen by any government agency. The only way to protect against it, absent those four very narrow areas, is with a collective bargaining agreement, with a good union contract that prohibits employers from taking arbitrary actions against us, that prohibits employers from disciplining or discharging people without just and sufficient cause. And that's the real world, and that's the real world right here in Pennsylvania in 2011, Rick. We're not talking about 1865, and we're not talking about Alabama.
Yeah, you know, I was listening. I went to the press conference, sat through about an hour and 10 minutes of
speech. Did you hear how wonderful things are in Texas from that great leader of the Associated Builders and Crushers?
I did, actually, and it was quite amazing that, well, here he is right here. This, I love this quote.
From 1986 to 2001, I lived in Texas. Texas is a right-to-work state. Texas is a great state.
That's his talking point. It's a right-to-work state. It's a great state.
Well, you know, if it's so great, why doesn't he and all his kind just leave Pennsylvania and go back to where they think things are good?
Here's the statement I love the most. This you're going to love this. Listen to this.
I saw oil go from $80 or $90 a barrel down to $15 a barrel in the late 80s. That was not a fun time. And I also saw it rebound to $85. You can't imagine the size and the depth and the breadth of an economic boom in a right-to-work state.
Nope. Can't imagine the size and the depth of that boom.
Well, I can imagine the depth. It's about as deep as the oil wells that, amazingly, in a state like Texas, have an extraction tax attached to them, where the deep stuff here in Pennsylvania, the Marcellus shale fields, somehow or another isn't amenable to that.
I mean, you know, the talking points that I got from these folks were just scary stuff. This other guy, and I don't mean to be playing a bunch of clips, but I love these talking points.
If we were to do that, all the things that were that are good would happen to arrive here soon.
All the things that were good would come. Just pass right to work. All of them. All the good
things. All the good things. High infant mortality, low education rates, all the good stuff.
Well, you know, I guess to somebody.
Low wages, high exploitation.
Well, to them, they're all the people on that stage represented business. Those were business interests. And to them, what you just said is good.
Well, it's interesting that we see this array of people, elected officials like Metcalf. I almost said Mad Cow. That would have been a mistake. That would have been disrespectful. Metcalf and these business goons, they're all there to protect us working folks. Once again, my voice, my interface with my government needs a translator for me. The translator has to be somebody who can tell me about the old boom in Texas, who can tell me how great right to work was in Texas, who can tell me as a leader of the Manufacturers Association that everything that could possibly be good in the world would happen for me as a worker if that rich business guy could just get even more rights to beat me up.
Yeah, you know, the idea is if we fill their pockets enough, eventually they get so full that things spill out. And
now,
we fight over those.
You know, the greatest myth that we live in today is that what we got to do is cut their taxes more, and all that's going to do is spur on development, take away rights and cut taxes. So we have a company like General Electric. General Electric pays zero in taxes, in fact, gets a refund for tax credit. And they cut 20% of their workforce. That's how we have this no-tax investment, making jobs, making good jobs, right here in the good old U.S. of A. General Electric, a good old U.S. of A company, pays no taxes to the U.S. of A, pays taxes all over the rest of the world where they operate, and so they cut their workforce 20% in the United States.
And close 28 factories.
And close 28 factories. Thank you, Mr. General Electric.
And he, the CEO, is the job czar here in the country.
Yeah, well, czar is an interesting word. I guess maybe when the czars had planned economies in the former Soviet Union, these kinds of things worked a little better.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with our good friend, attorney Irwin Aronson. You know, Irwin, a whole bunch of really destructive bills to change gears a little bit are working their way through the legislature here, and it's about thresholds. And I think it's going to, you know, a lot of people, you start talking about these threshold limits and what they mean. People's eyes kind of glaze over and I don't want to know anything about it. Explain a little bit exactly what these bills are and why they're bad.
Well, I can explain what we have now that's good, and then I'll explain why what they're proposing is bad. And I appreciate you asking me the question because it is one of those really hot topics. And just like right to work has sort of a nice ring to it until you peel the onion. Raising the thresholds somehow or another makes all kinds of sense until you really look at it. There is a framework of laws that exist in the state of Pennsylvania that govern the political subdivisions of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the cities, the townships, the boroughs, the school districts, the water authorities, the sewer authorities, the housing authorities, the public authorities, the industrial development authorities, and so on. And each one of these statutes sets a minimum threshold above which, in the name of open government and taxpayer accountability, above the amount of which contracts for the purchase of goods or services has to be submitted to public bid so that all comers bid and the lowest responsible bidder gets the award. This package of legislation that you're talking about regarding thresholds is a proposal to increase the thresholds that currently exist below which the communities, the kinds of communities that I described, would not have to advertise for public bidding from either $4,000 or $10,000 all the way up to $25,000, a minimum of a 250% increase. Imagine if people were getting a wage increase of 250%. And then it further keys them to an escalator that would automatically increase it from the 250% minimum increase every year, continuing to go up. And that means that it would sweep 250% more dollar value, at least, in contracts under the rug, out of the public eye, and into the backroom deal business, so that politicians at every one of these governmental levels could stop publicly bidding contracts and award contracts to their pals. Now, at a basic level, that's pretty offensive. But in the context of the last election cycle, where in 2010 all that we heard about was that we need to have taxpayer accountability, we need to have openness in government, we need to have transparency.
Sunshine.
This was the UN cry of the so-called Tea Party advocates. This was the UN cry of the Republicans who were running against the Democratic incumbents, because they claimed that Governor Rendell here in Pennsylvania, among others, was guilty of all these backroom kind of deals that, of course, they never proved on awarding of public contracts. But here they are, right out front, after having criticized the $4,000 threshold, increasing the threshold to $25,000. And when we go on the $4,000 one instead of the $10,000 or the $10,000 one, we're not talking about a mere 250% increase. We're talking about a several thousand percent increase. Let's get real here.
What about their argument? And there's an argument that I've heard that on a very small scale, it makes some sense, that every job that they bid, they have to put in the newspaper, and they're saying that it's kind of costly.
I think it is costly, that they do have to, under the current statutory framework, they do have to advertise things in newspapers of general circulation so that potential bidders and the taxpayers who are financing the bills for these things actually get to know about them. But if indeed the problem is that the cost of advertising is expensive, then the solution for that isn't to take away the protection, it's to take away the advertising cost. Why not establish a website statewide under the auspices of the Pennsylvania Department of General Services, where all local government entities could post for free on the website the advertising for any request for proposals for public contracts and public works? It would cost absolutely nothing, and it would be out there not in two advertisements 10 days apart in general circulation newspapers. It could be there for 45 or 60 days.
Yeah, the problem is that makes too much sense, Erwin.
Well, you know what? The problem is that in the name of protecting taxpayers, these charlatans are engaged in a wholesale rape, and the only thing we know is that when their lips are moving, they're telling us lies.
And there is the perfect place to wrap up, because it's the truth. I stood there and watched. I watched with flowery language and such you know, nice, well-dressed people lying to me like crazy.
Well, any time a boss stands in front of a microphone to tell us how he's here to help the workers, hold on to your wallets and hold on to your hats.
Not like my grandfather always said, if a rich guy's going to take a buck out of his pocket to convince you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it.
You bet.
Erwin, thanks for your time, brother.
Thank you, brother. Take good care, and always good to hear your voice.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
They're back. Actually, they never left. They just laid low while the heat of political anger blew over. They are the schemers and scammers of Wall Street, who devised the phantasmagoric money-from-nothing good times machine that was fueled by indecipherable derivatives and other financial fairy dust. If you're presently stuck in hard economic times, you have them to thank, for it was their hocus-pocus, poof, imploded our economy in 2008. Responding to public outrage, President Obama and the Democratic Congress passed a reform bill last year that tightened the rules on these tricksters. But now, with Wall Street hugging Republicans running the House and Obama himself turning Wall Street friendly,
The schemers and scammers are demanding that Washington loosen those pesky rules so they can restart that good times machine for their own fun and profit. For example, the biggest banks are pressing hard for the Treasury Department to exempt a derivatives game called foreign exchange swaps from any regulation. These gambles on the ups and downs of foreign currencies are not only risky, they're massive, with some $4 trillion being bet on them every day. A hiccup in this speculative game can ruin the day of a whole country. But a handful of Wall Street giants rake in about $9 billion a year handling these high-rolling bets, and they don't want the public even seeing what they're doing. Don't regulate us, they say. Trust us. They assert that the currency game is the one derivatives market that did not crash in 2008. This is Jim Hightower saying, not so fast, Slick. The only reason it did not crash is that the Federal Reserve poured more than $5 trillion into foreign central banks that year to prop it up. To keep up with these tricksters, check out Americans for Financial Reform. They're at www.ourfinancialsecurity.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you got questions, comments, something on your mind, want to join the discussion, what are your thoughts on this Columbia deal? Personally, I think it's a screw job, but, you know, what did you expect? Joseph Stiglitz came out with an article in Vanity Fair, which I think is well worth the read, and I've been using a couple of quotes from it this week. It's called, Of the 1%, By the 1%, For the 1%. And I've got a link over to our Facebook page to it. And I think it's interesting. He writes, the fat and the furious, the top 1% may have the best houses, education, and lifestyles, but their fate is bound up in how the other 99% live. He's talking about the reality of being the top 1%, really the top 400 people. And this has been worked out. He says the top 1% control 40% of the wealth income in the country. But the reality is the top 400 people control 60% of the wealth of the country. So while this top 1% is taking 40% of the income, they're also controlling massive amounts of wealth. And while, you know, the top 1% has seen their incomes skyrocket, working people across this country have not. And he points out that men with high school degrees only have seen their incomes decline 12% over the last quarter of a century. He goes on to talk about the realities being we're not much different than the old centers of inequality like Latin America, you know, Brazil. We're not different than that much different than Russia right now with its oligarchs or Iran because of the amount of the gap between those who have and those who do not. And the difference is we've got some safety net programs that keep people buoyed up a little bit. And even poor people in this country, we look at as better off than poor people in Iran or Ethiopia or Rwanda or Darfur. And it's true. But that's not the argument that should be made here. The way you have a growing economy, the way you have, the nation that we want is to have income equality across the breadth of the population, not just concentrated in the hands of a very few. And he talks about how economists came up with this idea that inequality was okay. It wasn't so troubling. And their justification was called the marginal productivity theory, which he says in a nutshell, this theory associated higher incomes with higher productivity and a greater contribution to society. Going on this premise that the rich, you know, they work harder, they're smarter, they're more productive, which I don't know if you've been paying attention, but if you looked at all the things that happened on Wall Street, those were supposed to be the very wealthy, highly productive, smart people who crashed our economy. And before they crashed the economy, and he points this out, they called those big multi-million dollar bonuses performance bonuses. But then when they weren't when they were losing their shirt and the bottom was falling out of the economy, we were losing hundreds of thousands of jobs a month, we needed to retain them. So we needed retention bonuses, even for the bankers who were losing money hand over fist. We needed to retain the bad people. And, you know, he goes into this whole argument of why this inequality is bad. And he points out, there are a couple of things he points out, that the growing inequality is bad for opportunity. That if you don't have equality, if you don't have the ability to move up, it's going to shrink opportunity, which in turn will then hurt productivity. His second argument is, he says, many of the distortions that led to inequality, such as those associated with monopoly power and preferential tax treatment for special interests, undermine the efficiency of the economy. So basically what we're doing is we're handing all of these tax rewards off to the very few who have the lobbyists who can go in there and get their little piece of it so that they benefit. And the corporations who, like GE, who have teams of tax attorneys and former IRS agents who can manipulate the system to get them out of paying for things. Thus, we get to shoulder the burden. He goes on to say, third, and perhaps the most important, the modern economy requires collective action. And this is something that, again, you know, none of this stuff is new. It's stuff we've all talked about. But here's a Nobel Prize winning economist, former head of the IMF. This is a guy who, honestly and truthfully, has got all the pedigree. And he's saying, look, we need a tax system that's gonna be fairer. We need better opportunity by shrinking the inequality, and we need collective action. He says that the reality is government needs to invest in infrastructure, education, and technology. And he points out the realities that without public investment, no internet. Without a lot of public investment, no advances in healthcare. And we could go on. You know, the space program benefited corporate America wildly with all of the offshoot products and all of the technology that came out of that. So, I mean, there was so much that came out of there. You think of government investment in highways and roads and bridges and railroads and airports and all that stuff that corporations didn't do. We did that collectively. He goes on to say about having this wealth class. He said the rich don't need to rely on government for parks or education or medical care or personal security. They can buy all these things for themselves. He says, in the process, they become more distant from ordinary people, losing whatever empathy they may have once had. They also worry about strong government, and as I've been saying, the one who could use its powers to adjust the balance, to take some of their wealth and invest it for the common good. The top 1% may complain about this kind of government, we have in America, but the truth of the matter is they like it just the way it is. Too gridlocked to redistribute, too divided to do anything but lower taxes. And he points out that unions have been under attack. At one point, union membership was a third of the American workers belonging to labor unions. Now it's under 12%. And that's the reason we have this massive inequality. The other part? They've got the money to lobby. They've got the ability to monopolize. You know, he points out from Rockefeller to Gates, this lax enforcement of antitrust laws, all things that we've been talking about, all the things that we've been talking about for years on this program, he points out in this piece. So I think it's absolutely worth a read. And he says, look, Jake, we're doing inequality at a world-class level. We are doing it so well that everyone else, all those other countries that have dictators and peasants, they're envious. Envious of us because we're so good at it.
Well, the irony is, you take a country like China, the Chinese in some ways, in some areas, are actually more capitalistic than we are. Pure open market, if you will. Their version of open market. That's how bad we become. That's how narrow we become, our vision. That's how the wealth, all the assets of this country are being controlled by fewer and fewer and fewer people. And that's absolutely, clearly, Anybody with any common sense looks at that and says that is not good, not only from an economic standpoint, but more important for our freedoms and our democracy long term.
So now I bring this back to Columbia, because this is where Stiglitz goes with this, back to Columbia. He talks about globalization. He says with the top 1% in charge and paying no price for the wars because their kids don't serve in the military because our army doesn't pay enough. So, and they don't have to raise taxes because we just borrow the money. We didn't ask the wealthiest people in the country to pay for Iraq or Afghanistan. No, no. We borrowed it. We put it on the children's credit cards way into the future. But he says the top 1% in charge are paying no price. The notion of balance and restraint goes out the window. There's no limit to adventures that we can undertake. Corporations and contractors stand only to gain. The rules of economic globalization are likewise designed to benefit the rich, which is exactly what I'm saying about this Colombian Free Trade Agreement. It's not about you and me. It's not about creating jobs. It's not about that at all. It's about them. It's about benefiting the ultra wealthy. It's about opening up that country to investment and protecting them. Protecting the investor class, protecting their investment. He says, imagine what a world might look like if the rules were designed instead of encouraging competition among countries for workers. Governments would compete on providing economic security, low taxes on ordinary wage earners, good education, and a clean environment. Things workers care about, but the top percent don't need to care about. And again, I go back to these trade agreements. I go back, who do they benefit? They don't benefit us. They benefit them. And you want to know? This is class war. And I think this Stiglitz article is just fantastic. It's worth the read. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Amy Morton, Executive Director of CAIU, on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Health Insurance.
By moving to Capital Blue Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of health care and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
You know, that's exactly what's going on. In fact, when we give all this money to the top 1%, where do they run? They run to other countries. They take that money, they invest it in China and India and all around the globe, which is why I think it's interesting. As I was flipping through the pages of the Wall Street Journal today, the newspaper of the investor class, I came across an article that I got to be honest, I was completely shocked by. It was titled IMF Shifts Stance on Capital Controls, which is basically saying, look, maybe we were wrong. Maybe having completely open borders so hot money can rush across borders freely is not such a great idea. And the article goes back and forth. You know, they're it's hard to get off this idea that the free market is always going to work and that they're going to be able to have a situation where the investors, you know, they know better. Well, you know what the investors know? Herd mentality. Because if you look at a number of countries throughout the years that have gone through, Mexico, for one, went through a huge wave of money leaving their currency collapsing. You know, go back to 2001 when, because we weren't paying attention. We were busy with our own problems. September 11th had just happened. All of the herd money flew out of Argentina. All the hot money came out of Argentina, and the country basically collapsed because they had gone along with the IMF. They had gone along with the World Bank, and they privatized all their social services, so they didn't have a safety net at all. It had all been privatized. They had no unemployment. They had no welfare. They had none of that stuff. It had all, in order to get the loan, they had to do away with all that stuff and privatize it all. So the people were really walking the high wire without a net. But it made a great place for business to invest. It was great. In fact, up until the day it collapsed, you had the conservatives touting how wonderful a place Argentina was for investors because they were getting such a huge return and the economy was smoking hot. Then 9/11 happens and everybody pulls back. Everybody yanks their money out and the country literally overnight collapses. Factories across the country shut down. Workers thrown out into the streets. Nothing to do because the investor class left them. This is what these agreements do. This is what these agreements are meant to do. It's to tear down these capital borders, whatever restrictions that you may have. Now, look, Colombia, they're going to have to tear down their borders to our investors, and our investors are going to reap massive rewards in the country of Colombia, in the country of South Korea. Why do you think the workers in South Korea are saying, hell no, we don't want that? Because they understand what it means. They're going to get jobs on the short term. They're going to. We are going to send jobs over there. You bet that's going to happen. But at the end of the day, what it's going to happen is we're going to tear down those walls, and money from our investor class that we give them. I mean, this is what I love about this whole thing. They invest it, they pay 15% tax, a lot less than we pay working for a living. And now they want to cut that down even further. They want to cut corporate taxes down to 25% so they can have all the availability of all this hot money to go all around the world and invest. And finally, somebody at the IMF said, you know what? Maybe for some stability, we should stop that. And all the other people who are tied up in this are saying, no, we just need to adjust it a little bit. And maybe, you know, under certain circumstances, maybe consider. I think they're coming to the reality, like Alan Greenspan came to after the economy collapsed, that everything he believed was wrong. Mm-hmm. Maybe now we're starting to see this global policy that we've set up that has extracted the wealth from the working class. Which is what it was meant to do, Jake. It was meant to strip you and I from that, well, how dare they drive the same kind of car, and how dare they eat in the same kind of restaurants.
Well, it's a house of cards, and here, you know, that you can make that comparison to this country. If things keep going this way, eventually, those people who need to understand that you need to give back a little bit in taxes and you need to relinquish some of your power, are the ones who are going to suffer if the system totally collapses. Because if it totally collapses, everybody will suffer. Not to mention, there might be some very, very angry people in America.
And this is where the Tea Party people and I are on the same page. I was angry about the bailouts. If you remember, you were sitting there the day they talked about it. You knew what my reaction was. My reaction was, hell no, let them fail. But then over time, as we began to explore what hell no, let them fail means, it meant all of us went with it. And to be honest, I would have, if I were in Congress at the time, I would have cast the vote to bail those no good criminal cretins out, because it would have been us too.
Well, we
but instead of, and this is what gets me, instead of saying, we're going to bail you out, but we're going to break you up, and we're going to separate more, and we're going to have some more competition, some more controls, we did just the opposite. We gave them the money, and they used our money to buy us even more. Mm-hmm. That's what frustrates me, and that's where I got to tell you, I think I have common ground with the Tea Party.
There were no safeguards. Well, not only should they... Whether you could have done it, I don't know. It's a great idea, Eric, to go back to the way it used to be and the philosophy of local community banks, regional banks. But certainly, we should have expected them. Whether you're using logic, whether you're using morality, you would expect these people to do what they're supposed to do, and that is loan money. They're not doing that. They're using that money. They're using the prosperity which was given to them by the taxpayers of the United States, and they're buying up other banks. Which makes the system even worse. I don't think we could have left them go down. That would have hurt everybody, but certainly the huge mistake was to not put enough safeguards into the system.
My problem, again, and going back to if I remember it vividly, viscerally saying let them fail. Let all of those investors, because that's what happens when investments. When you buy an investment product, you are investing saying, you know, I'm going to get a good return because there's risk here. But when you started to look at how bad it would have been to let them go down, that's where I wasn't willing to make that gamble, much like what's going to happen tomorrow if there's not an agreement made. If Congress and if Boehner can't stop moving the goalposts further and further to the extreme right, and Democrats can't decide to stand their ground, at some point that we're going to be talking about a government shutdown, is a horrible...
And what's your take on that? My take is, you know, if they're going to do it, let's do it now. Let's do it now.
Oh, I'm not in favor of another continuing resolution.
Let's call their bluff. And if, you know, there are already polls out there. At this point, I don't know that polls is the right thing. But if you don't, when does this end? Do we do it again another week or month or whenever the next deadline is? Is this just going to be repeated and repeated and repeated? And the Republicans are going to say, well, you know, we're not going to agree to it unless you agree to every dollar of cuts we want. I don't think so. At some point, the Democrats are going to draw a line in the sand. As long as they're reasonable, already there's some Democrats saying, look, we gave up more than we should have. They originally agreed, Republicans originally agreed, then they moved the goalpost when Boehner had as you're so fond of saying, the teeth whizzlers putting pressure on him.
I think at the end of this, and if it all goes the way I think it may, we're going to shut down for a short time. I do think both the Democrats and the Boehner Republicans, not the Tea Party people, will then turn their sights on the Tea Party and eat them and cannibalize them and blame them for pushing it.
Did you?
I think that is what's going to happen.
Did you get the impression? I thought maybe it's just me. You watch Boehner, and he comes from these Republican meetings behind closed doors, and he has this pained expression like, oh, God, why am I here? Why do I have to do this? Why me? It's like he's caught in this giant vice.
Good.
And he can't move. And it's like, wow, I really don't want to do this, but I have to if I want to stay in this position.
But at the end of it, what has to happen is, the reality is we've got to blame those who are to blame for this. They came out, they said $31 million was acceptable. They made an agreement, and then they reneged on it. Then they said, no, well, we want more, and then the Democrats kept moving, because that's what Democrats do, and the Republicans know that, figuring that, oh, we can get them all the way over where we want them. And I think finally the Democrats have had enough, and I guess the president and the leaders are having a meeting as we speak. So it should be interesting to see what news comes out of that, because tomorrow is the deadline. Now, what happens with that 72-hour rule that's supposed to be out there? I mean, Friday's the deadline. What happens to the 72-hour rule? We're already past the ability for that. Interesting questions. But anyway, going back to this Colombian thing, I am just flipping mad about it, because, you know, the guy looked me in the eye. And it's one of those things, and maybe he does believe that he's putting strong labor protections in there. Maybe he believes that he's upholding his word. I'm just not seeing.
Well, there's another issue, Rick. I mean, let's say that the Colombian government is 100% honest. They're going to do everything they can to enforce these laws. I guess my question is, are they strong enough? You know, there's some powerful adversaries against the government.
You know, we were at the healthcare conference not too long ago, and we sat down with New York Representative Joe Crowley, and he had this to say, which I thought was
interesting. The Columbia Free Trade Agreement isn't so much about the jobs end of it here. It has more to do, I think, with the fact that you have labor organizers who have
been
killed.
Out of planes, sure.
Who have been killed, and killed in Columbia, and I think they have. It's not just about labor. It's about human rights, generally speaking. There's been a culture of death within that country.
A culture of death. And I think that sums it up pretty well. That sums it up pretty well. Because if you look at, one of the stories that I was reading today that, they've arrested some soldiers, and some civilians for basically killing people. Dressing them up in rebel clothes, killing them and taking credit for killing these people. It is this culture of death. And, you know, is this the kind of country we want to be doing business with? Now, they have been, they had one of our allies, and we've been, they've been there sticking their thumb in Chavez's eye. They've done some of our military bidding, I guess, on the border there. But at the end of it, is that enough? For me, the worry is this is the wrong message at the wrong time. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy!
Your working class radio experience.
Where hard work, common sense, and rational thought
are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left, reaching out.
too classy.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. I don't know if you've been paying attention to this this Wisconsin Republican Paul Ryan's budget. Basically, in a nutshell, we're going to slash funding for everything that helps people below $50,000 a year. Can cut them off at the knees. Let's make it $100,000. Anything that helps people under $100,000, we're going to slash them at the knees. We're going to destroy Medicare. We're going to end that. We're going to go to a voucher program. Because we love vouchers. Republicans just seem to love vouchers. Maybe it's the act of actually giving something. Here's a piece of paper. Here's your gold ticket. Here's a voucher. Granted, you're not going to go anywhere with it, but you have a nice shiny piece of paper. Like they gave you something. You remember when Bush gave out money? Wanted to make you feel special. They were going to give out $300 a person. Do you remember that, Jake? They sent out a letter first. Do you remember this? They actually sent out a letter mm-hmm. saying, your check could be on the way. So that when you went out to the box, you go, hey, I got a letter from the president. All right. Oh, my check away. Oh, boy. And every day you'd run out to the mailbox and you'd wait for your Bush prize. Is my George W. here today? You open the box. No, darn. And then when it came, he gave you $300 and everyone thought, wow, George Bush is the greatest guy on earth. He gave us our money back. He gave us money back. He didn't give it to you back. What he did is he borrowed it. And now you're going to pay it back for years to come. But what he also did is he gave massive tax breaks to those at the very top. And he put this country on a path towards total destruction so that they could end all of those programs that they've hated for so long. You know, you got to be honest, that Mission Accomplished banner, they should keep that. Because there's a lot of things that Mission Accomplished would be apropos for, like the destruction of Medicare, which they've been against from the beginning. The destruction of Social Security, which they've been against from the beginning. The destruction of rights of workers to have a voice. They've been against that from the beginning. All of that stuff. Unemployment benefits, been against that. Workmen's compensation, been against that. Why? Because it's not business friendly. Personally, on the workers' comp front, I'm almost in favor of saying doing completely away from it and going back to the good old days when you could take your employer to court and sue them personally. Because if you know anything about workers' comp, that's basically what happened. You gave up your constitutional right to sue that employer off the security of knowing that your medical bills and some of your wages would be covered. But over the years, what's happened is they've rolled that back, rolled it back, rolled it back. So that more of the liability is on you, the one who's least able to shoulder that responsibility. But that's America. Land of the individual. Unless you're a corporation, then you need bailing out. And again, you know, going back to the housing crisis, I would have bailed out the people at the bottom. But that's just me. Anyway, this destruction of Medicare. It's kind of interesting that during the Obamacare discussion, the Republicans went crazy saying that, well, we've guaranteed that, you know, that all this did was, you know, make everyone buy private insurance. So everyone's going to have to buy insurance. What do you think this destruction of Medicare is? This is now going to destroy the government program and make you buy into a private insurance program. Do you know how much money the private insurance industry has given Representative Paul Ryan? Since 1997, almost $675,000. Now you go, ah, that doesn't sound like an awful lot. You know, $675,000, yeah, that's not an awful lot. That's a lot of money. It's an awful lot of money. And what this whole thing is a massive transfer of wealth. From you, Jake, you're not your generation, but people like you, people who are going to eventually be on Medicare. Well, no, you're going to be all right. They're going to take care of you. It's me who's screwed. Because when I go to get what the seniors have today, which is basically guaranteed health care, I'm going to be fed to the wolves. Because if you have any conditions, it's going to cost you a lot more than that little voucher, Jake. Which I, I want to know why people aren't in the streets.
Well, I don't think the average person understands if you look at that, and some Democrats have, and they said exactly what you're saying. Look, those vouchers aren't going to be enough. So there's going to be an outcry. And the hope of the Republicans is, well, you know, we tried it this way. We tried to modify it. We tried to help the people that used to be on Medicare. Why don't we try privatization? You know, that's coming. They're setting the groundwork right here. I mean, you got to give them credit. I hope and pray that it doesn't work. I don't think it will, but one never knows.
You know, I went home last night, and you know, I got to stop doing this. At some point, I'm going to just go home and go to bed. But I get caught up watching C-SPAN because I'm there must be some C-SPAN Anonymous or something out there. You know, like AA or something for me to go to stop watching C-SPAN all the time. But I started watching. Well, first it was Geithner getting beat up by the Senate. They don't want to raise the debt ceiling. And Geithner's saying, look, not raising the debt ceiling is unimaginable. It's unthinkable. It is incredibly destructive. And the longer that we wait in moving forward on raising the debt ceiling a little bit, the worse it's going to be for us. And again, you know, I'm not a big fan of raising the debt ceiling, but there has to be a time where rational thought plays into this. If we default on our loans, it's going to make credit almost impossible for generations. It's going to ruin our ratings around the world, and it's going to make everything more expensive for us, including our debt. So the $14.2 trillion debt that we have now will then become more expensive. Because one of the things that the Fed has done, and you could make the argument one way or another that it's a good thing, it's a bad thing, but by having near zero rate interest rates, we're not paying an awful lot of money in interest out on the massive debt that we have. By defaulting, those rates shoot up. And this is the whole rationale that I have. I'm thinking down the road going, you know, by the time we make our point, it's going to cost us a whole boatload more money down the road. What we should be doing is raising revenue. And there's so much revenue that we're leaving on the table. And we're still talking about doing destructive things like shutting down the government, like defaulting on our obligations. I mean, stop and think about that for a minute, Jake. In this country, did you ever think that simultaneously we'd be talking about shutting down our government and defaulting on the good name of our credit? I never thought we would, to be honest. But here we are. You've got these T-Twizzlers who are hell-bent for leather. And what bothers me, again, like I said, we are going to have a problem down the road. And especially when you look at the fact that, like what you talked about yesterday, the fact that you've got hedge fund managers in this country, the top 25 hedge fund managers who took $850 million apiece last year, paid 15% tax on it. The year before, they took $1 billion apiece and paid 15% tax on that money. And yet, a guy who's making 50 grand a year out there busting his behind pays more than that. That is sickening. And I say, you know what? We've got billionaire hedge fund managers. Maybe we should ask them to contribute, because after all, times are tough. Need a little sacrifice. You know, where's the generation that's going to step up and say, let me take care of it? You know, where's our investor class who, like during World War II, said, yes, tax us at 92%? Where are those people? They're sitting in their country clubs. They're sitting in on their private jets, flying to their private islands. Oh, but Rick, you're just talking class war. You're just talking class war. Yeah, absolutely. We're right back after this.
Hey, working man like me. I ain't never been on welfare. And that's one place I'll be working. As long as my two hands are fit to use, I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing
These working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg. Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
AFSCME President Gerald McEntee says the Republican budget plan cutting $6 trillion over 10 years by gutting Medicare and Medicaid is a disaster for working people. The Service Employees International Union President Mary Kay Henry says it's an all-out assault on children, seniors, and the disabled. The Center for American Progress's Pat Garofalo says that Representative Paul Ryan's GOP budget plan destroys Medicare and Medicaid as we know them and repeals the Affordable Health Care Act. Garofalo says if budgets are moral documents, this is the Republican morality writ large.
This says morally that the government does not have an obligation to care for the poor, the old. It doesn't have an obligation to educate and create a 21st century workforce because it cuts Pell Grants to the bone. It basically says that those who are well off will continue to be well off and not have to, you know, pay to support the society that helped them get well off. They don't think we have a responsibility to take care of seniors. They don't think we have a responsibility to take care of the poor. They're willing to raise taxes on the middle class in order to cut them for the rich. And when they want to implement budget cuts, the only budget items they look at are the ones that help people in the middle class and on the lower end of the income scale. It's gutting the social safety net, throwing tax breaks to the rich and corporations, and hoping that everything shakes out in the end.
On April 4th, 2011, while hundreds of rallies, marches, and vigils were taking place throughout the country in memory of Dr. Martin Luther King, one of the men that stood by his side the day he was assassinated was in Madison, Wisconsin, addressing an audience of nearly 10,000. Jackson and King were in Memphis that week to march in solidarity with striking sanitation workers. Two of those Memphis sanitation workers stood side by side with Jackson in Wisconsin. Jackson said there's no room for the current disparity gripping the United States in a democracy as envisioned by King. He said the best way to honor the civil rights activist's memory is by following his mantra of keep hope alive.
It is Queen time, it is hell time, it is Martin Luther King time. Keep hope alive. Go, 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 go.
Winds Jesse Russell reporting from Madison. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals, and by the National Association of Letter Carriers. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared.
Not today, but I shook one's hand yesterday, if that counts for anything, and that was difficult. Like I said the other day when we talked with Representative Keller, I don't know how he does it. I don't know, he sits across the table from them without reaching across and strangling one of them, especially Metcalf, him and his attack on anyone having rights at work. Just amazing stuff. Just absolutely mind-boggling. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. I came across an article that I thought was important, written by a guy named Harvey Kay. He's a professor in Wisconsin. It's Will the Florida GOP Dishonor the Greatest Generation? And I think it's well worth the read. It's linked at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Harvey Kay's name. Let's talk to Harvey. Harvey, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Rick. Good to hear your voice again.
I look at this article and I agree that while it's great that the Florida Republicans are going around the state honoring what's called the greatest generation, maybe they should honor some other things as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this has been going on ever since the 90s. In fact, probably has been going on ever since For those of us who remember, Ronald Reagan went to the 40th anniversary of Normandy, the Normandy invasion in 1984, where the emphasis on the military bravery and the military courage and the military victory, which is warranted, has really sort of narrowed what the greatest generation, in quotes, was all about. I mean, this was a generation that young, very young men and women in the 1930s who helped not only create the New Deal and all of the things that we have benefited from of FDR's generation ever since, but also this was a generation that fought labor struggles. This was a generation that transformed the American landscape. This was a generation that essentially expanded American freedom, equality, and democracy here at home further and probably more than any generation in American history.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I get into arguments though sometimes, just for full disclosure with my buddy here, because he says it's the greatest generation ever, and look, they were a great generation, but I think most of it was out of necessity. When your back is against the wall, you have to lash out. So that, just for full disclosure.
Well, who's your buddy there?
My buddy Jake.
I think Jake is probably right. I think they were the greatest generation. But you know why they were the greatest generation? Because they were the most progressive generation. That's my point.
Okay.
Okay. This, I mean, seriously speaking, if you think about what they did in the course of the late 30s and through the 1940s, I mean, seriously, think about Social Security. Think about the organization of the American working class on an unprecedented scale. Think about the CCC and the refurbishment of the American wilderness and the American landscape. Here in Wisconsin, the fighting of soil erosion and the creation of parks. Think about the WPA, where it put people out there, where they were building roads, creating parks. The PWA, which built buildings all across the United States. I mean, it was absolutely unprecedented kind of transformation of American life. And it really did create a far more equal and a far more democratic society. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, this was a generation that had its flaws. I mean, that was a generation that was marked by anti-Semitism and racism. But at the very same time, they somehow transcended all of that, led by an extraordinary president, Franklin Roosevelt, to really remake, is a good way of putting it, the United States. I mean, it really, in some ways, was a revolutionary moment.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I take the premise that their backs were against the wall, their stomachs were empty, therefore they had one direction to go, and I think that was the one they chose was the right one.
And fortunately they did, because people sometimes say to me, oh, how much difference does a generation make? How much difference does a president make? And I ask them to consider if by some chance Herbert Hoover had won in 1932. Ask them if perhaps Roosevelt hadn't won again in 1936. I mean, if you think about the fact that they really did make the right decision.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, it's interesting. There are, I sometimes say to people, I say to my students, who are the three greatest presidents in American history? Now, historians who are asked, as well as our fellow citizens, generally say Washington, Lincoln, and Roosevelt.
That's what, okay? I would have said.
And then I say to them, well, why do you think that is? And the instinctive reply is, well, the American Revolution, the Civil War, and World War II. And I say, no. You know what? That's the mythology.
That would have been my response.
Well, of course. But if you actually think about it, those are the three greatest moments. Up until then, again, and you might say the civil rights victories of the 1960s, those were the three greatest moments in the story of American democracy. Because you've got the creation of the United States, the Revolution. You've got a civil war in which you destroy destroy slavery and liberate African Americans. And in the 1930s, working people liberated themselves. Now, and the presidents were Washington, Lincoln, and Roosevelt. That's why those are the three greatest presidents.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I would have said Washington because he was one who didn't want to be king. He could have been president for life.
He did
relinquish power. To me, that right there is one of the greatest accomplishments he had.
Although I have to tell you, just for the sake of to get the history straight, if he had tried to pull that, they would have had a civil war in the United States then. Because Americans who fought that revolution had every expectation they were going to get a republic. So, but it's not to say they would, that he could not have sustained himself in a kingly fashion. But Americans really were committed in a, to a democratic republic. That I think we owe to Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson.
Right. So let's talk about this. You know, some of the things that the New Deal brought us, Social Security, unemployment, a lot of the protections for workers that Republicans have truly, honestly been against from the beginning, have been fighting to destroy ever since. And I have to be honest, they're doing a pretty good job of going back and undoing a lot of those protections. I guess, what does that say about us?
Well, you know, they never liked Social Security. They never liked the National Labor Relations Act. They never liked labor unions. But they had been compelled by the very scale of the American democratic mobilization in the 30s and 40s to try to live with it, which is why in the 1950s, Eisenhower did nothing to try to roll back the New Deal. Okay? One out of every three workers was in a labor union. Imagine if they had tried to take away workers' rights then. Okay? I mean, it was a disciplined labor movement in the 1950s. Now, that doesn't mean that when the opportunities arose, they didn't take full advantage of it. Big corporations and conservatives. And from the mid-70s on, even under Carter, labor witnessed defeat after defeat after defeat in legislative arena. And I was thinking this morning, you know, here we are, you know, I live in Wisconsin, and last night we had the all night wait for the election results
and well into this afternoon.
Yeah, and I woke up this morning and I was feeling a little low because things weren't looking very good at that moment. Then I got some phone calls telling me things were shifting. The votes from Madison were coming in, but I was still thinking to myself about the times in which we live, and I was thinking, is this really the first time that I can recall in which an American political movement is succeeding in taking away rights from their fellow citizens as opposed to blocking them for the first time ever, taking them away? You think about this time. This is the most, this may be the most un-American time in American history if we don't turn back the onslaught from the right.
That's an excellent point. And, you know, because right here in Pennsylvania yesterday, they decided they were going to push their no rights at work agenda, and a handful of the kooky cabal decided to put out right to work legislation.
Well, I hope that this victory here in Wisconsin, and I know there's going to be a recount, but I think we're going to win. I think this victory in Wisconsin should send a signal to working people, to the labor movement especially, that we can mobilize, we can turn things around. We're not going to do it overnight, but we can begin the long haul to reclaim America.
Let me ask you this, Harvey, because, you know, I've had some people say, well, it's only 204 votes. Is that really a mandate? Did you really turn this back when it only 204 votes?
You know, one of my colleagues sent me an interesting map, and then I think I saw the same map a little while ago, about an hour ago, on Rachel Maddow's TV show. There was if you look at Scott Walker's victory in 2010, okay, which I still don't quite grasp because it also cost us Russ Feingold. But in any case, if you look at that victory and you look at the counties that went red, you with me?
Yep.
And then you look at the counties that went blue today, or since they yesterday to today, what you see is a real rolling back. You see a definite rolling back of what happened in 2010.
Yeah, I think 19 counties flipped back.
Yeah, 19 counties flipped back. Now, I'm embarrassed to say that I'm in that northeastern part of the state, which was overwhelmingly red, okay? But the point is that what mattered is people turned out even up here. The thing I don't understand is we all turned out to protest these last numbers of weeks. And the Tea Party was really hiding away. I mean, even now, and I'm not saying that there was corruption, but it is still hard for me to conceive of all those conservatives turning out to give us the kind of competition we got. But the point is we won. And I believe this recount will see an increased number of votes for Kloppenberg, who was the liberal candidate. I feel great tonight. My wife and I celebrated with some extra ice cream tonight. We had a good time.
There you go. Go wild.
Well, yeah, that and a bit of wine made a good evening.
Nothing wrong with that at all.
Right.
But, you know, let's go back to your article for a second and compare that to what's going on. Because, you know, you're right. During the 30s and 40s, we did see an expansion of rights for everyday people. And now what we're seeing is that being taken
away. A contraction.
We're seeing that, taking it away, being reduced, a contraction. Compare that with the fact that now the president is talking about another, in a string of insane trade agreements. I'm not sure where I'm going here. I'm angry, frustrated. And it was a great win in Wisconsin, but at the end of the day, workers are still getting the shaft today.
Yeah, workers are still getting the shaft. And, I mean, at a certain point, the question is going to be, what do we do with this Democratic Party? Okay? How many Democratic presidents are we going to see giving away workers' power, workers' rights, workers' wages? I mean, how long is it, right? In 1978, the Carter administration failed to fight for the Labor Reform Act, which would have empowered labor and enabled it to more effectively organize, right?
Yep.
Clinton put NAFTA before health care, right? And then this time, whatever happened to EFCA, Employee Free Choice Act? I mean, labor is going to have to, one could say draw a line in the sand. The point is that the Democrats do best when the workers are most affected,
yep,
not when the workers are marginalized.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. When I went on air, I was just fit to be tied because this president did run one of the most pro-worker, pro-labor campaigns that I know in my lifetime.
Yeah, I mean, I had my reservations. I wasn't sure he had the fight in him.
Me too.
Okay, but nevertheless, you think about the fact that an African American drew the kind of turnout that he drew, and then garnered the majority in both houses of the, both houses of Congress, and they couldn't find it in themselves to go to bat for EFCA. I mean, my feeling is that you go to bat, you fight, and if you lose, then at least you've got the people behind you, and you can try again another day.
Yep.
I mean, I find this so depressing to watch this administration having pursued, even the Health Care Reform Act, which all of us are probably glad to see the expansion of healthcare to so many who didn't have it before. But how happy are we that we don't know if we're going to contain prices, and we've just given this massive giveaway to the health insurance industry?
Yep, I'm right there with you.
And I'm not saying this just to vent. I'm saying this because it really does show here in Wisconsin that if you can get the Democrats going, then maybe you've got a chance to get people mobilized. There is something else as well, that along with all of these policy questions, we have got to figure out a way that takes us back to the struggles of the 30s and also find a figure like Roosevelt, who not only stands with workers when he realizes that's the best way for him to accomplish things, but he also is then able to articulate, to express in inspiring words what working people are fighting for. I mentioned over and over again, I'm working on a book on the Four Freedoms, the great words of Roosevelt, 1941.
Right.
But my argument is that the Four Freedoms didn't come out of the head of a genius. It didn't come out of the head of an otherwise phenomenal president. Those were the aspirations of the labor movement for generations. And in the 1930s, Roosevelt picked up on those and articulated those as those Four Freedoms: freedom of speech and expression, freedom of worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. That was the labor movement. Those are the labor movement's ideals that he then expressed and articulated.
If only we could have a conversation with Obama and kind of instill that in him a little again. Because I think he preached that during the election.
He definitely preached that very kind of thing. What are we going to do?
Yep.
What are we going to do other than turn out, sign up, organize, and get more people like you on the radio?
Yeah, well, we're working on that.
Okay.
Harvey Kay, I appreciate your time. Great article. Again, if you want to read the article, it's over at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Harvey's name. It'll take you right there. Always great talking to you. We'll look forward to having you back again.
Thank you, and I'm always ready to come back.
All righty. Thanks, Harvey. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Drowning in crafty lies. Save the USA and resume the ties of mine. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job, join the people.
saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
They're back. Actually, they never left. They just laid low while the heat of political anger blew over. They are the schemers and scammers of Wall Street, who devised the phantasmagoric money-from-nothing good times machine that was fueled by indecipherable derivatives and other financial fairy dust. If you're presently stuck in hard economic times, you have them to thank, for it was their hocus-pocus that, poof, imploded our economy in 2008. Responding to public outrage, President Obama and the Democratic Congress passed a reform bill last year that tightened the rules on these tricksters. But now, with Wall Street hugging Republicans running the House and Obama himself turning Wall Street friendly, the schemers and scammers are demanding that Washington loosen those pesky rules so they can restart that good times machine for their own fun and profit. For example, the biggest banks are pressing hard for the Treasury Department to exempt a derivatives game called foreign exchange swaps from any regulation. These gambles on the ups and downs of foreign currencies are not only risky, they're massive, with some $4 trillion being bet on them every day. A hiccup in this speculative game can ruin the day of a whole country. But a handful of Wall Street giants rake in about $9 billion a year handling these high-rolling bets, and they don't want the public even seeing what they're doing. Don't regulate us, they say. Trust us. They assert that the currency game is the one derivatives market that did not crash in 2008. This is Jim Hightower saying, not so fast, Slick. The only reason it did not crash is that the Federal Reserve poured more than $5 trillion into foreign central banks that year to prop it up. To keep up with these tricksters, check out Americans for Financial Reform. They're at www.ourfinancialsecurity.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
It seems Glenn Beck is out. Fox News says they're going to end his show later in the year with some agreement that they're going to Fox News and Beck's Mercury Radio Arts Company are going to do some projects on their television and digital format. So basically, he's going to run a website, I think. And maybe they're going to try and, at the end of this, what's happened is his ratings have gone so far down. He's gone so far off the path that he's losing the mainstream conservative audience. And a number of people I've talked to believe that the only people who are really watching him are the lefties that he enrages, because they want to, they hang on to every word he says so that, you know, they can report on it. In fact, they think most of the people who listen to him, even on his radio program, are people who don't agree with him just so that they can use something against him. Personally, I don't listen to the guy. He's way off the beaten path. In the blocks of minutes that I have listened in the past, it's almost unlistenable, because there doesn't seem to be much cohesion there. But again, you know, the guy's worth a bunch of bucks. He's had a big audience, which is what the Fox network is going to bring you. When you have that kind of exposure, you're going to get a big audience. So this is them saying, you know what? We're going to pull back. You've gone a little too far. Now what's going to happen? You're going to see someone who, not as crazy, not going to go down the religion track. I think once he made that religion turn, that really kind of sunk his ship. You're going to find somebody much younger. You're going to find somebody very attractive to the young lasses, and he's not going to be quite as crazy.
Well, you know, saying that the president has a deep-seated hatred for white people didn't endear him to even Fox News.
He hates whitey.
Well, hey, I mean, you can laugh about it, but there were 400 advertisers that said, no, 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 we've had enough of the Beckster.
And again, like I said, he started losing money, he started losing audience.
He went from 2.7 to 2 million. That's he lost a lot of viewers just in 1 year.
I don't know if you've seen this, but in Juneau, Alaska, they're going to weigh in on the long-running argument. If you're old enough to fight and die for your country, you should be old enough to drink beer. They're going to try and push a bill to allow 18-year-olds to drink. Those under 19, which is Alaska's smoking age, can buy tobacco products. So they're saying, hey, if you've got a military ID, you can drink at 18. And I think the drinking age should be 18 anyway. Because I do believe that if you're old enough to die for your country, you should be at least able to have a beer. I think that's crazy to begin with. But it's interesting that they're spending a little time on legislation. Under the heading of maybe crazy cells, a new poll released by NBC and the Wall Street Journal shows that Republican primary voters have jumped on the Donald Trump crazy train. The NBC WSJ poll puts Trump in a statistical dead heat with Mitzi, and Mitzi's large war chest, also with Mike Huckleberry there, or it's Mike Huckleberry, isn't it?
Mike, yes.
They've got Mark here.
No, it's Mike.
Anyway, he's the and what's happened is the crazy train there with Trump on it has turned into the Tea Party, the Tea Party Express. And the truth of the matter is the Republican establishment can't be happy to have somebody like Trump at the head of it because you can't control him. He is, in my opinion, an egomaniac who's going to do whatever he can do to have people say, hey, look at me. I wish I could do that. I wish I was more narcissistic. I'm just not.
And, you know, the last couple of years I would see him on TV, and he seemed like very much a moderate. In fact, I remember him speaking up for the president. And now all of a sudden he wants to run for president, and, you know, he's appealing to Crazyville.
Well, he sent Nancy Pelosi, when she became speaker, he sent her a note saying, you know, I wish you the best of luck, which you know is going to come up in the election. You know, they're going to come after him. Anyway, Mitzi... news on with Mitzi. He's got a massive war chest, evidently. He's ramping up his fundraising machine because basically he just wants to crush the opposition here in 2012. The former Massachusetts governor has yet to formally announce he's getting into the race, but, you know, according to Reuters, he's out crisscrossing the country, meeting with very wealthy donors, doing that whole networking thing. They say he's got a massive war chest, something like $50 million. Jerry Berry. Jerry Berry. A professor of political science at Tufts University said that the money buys Romney the ability to run everywhere. It's a tremendous advantage, adding that early voting states like Iowa, South Carolina, and Nevada may look perilous for Romney, but he's got deep pockets, and he can live to fight on in the second round. Berry also points out that as a former chief executive of a private investment firm, Bain Capital, Romney has natural ties to the big money guys, and he's got a whole bunch of Wall Street people in his pocket that maybe his rivals don't. Evidently, according to Reuters, Romney met with 100 very, very wealthy donors in New York in late March, where he reportedly said he was going to need the $50 million, and he wanted $50,000 from each of those 100 donors. He himself has between $190 and $250 million, according to his 2008 election returns. He spent, evidently, in 2008, about $44 million of his own money. So kind of interesting times. To me, at the end of this, all of this money is dangerous to our politic. And we absolutely need campaign finance laws that are going to encourage people like you, Jake, to run for office by having publicly financed elections. Mm-hmm. In fact, actor Alec Baldwin was joined by Democratic Senator Dick Durbin and Representative John Larson today to unveil just such a bill. To get money out of politics and curb the special interest money. The Fair Election Now Act has been introduced, and they're saying, look, if Americans knew how much money and how much time congressmen have to spend raising money, you'd be shocked. So they're going out there trying to figure out how to have publicly financed elections, which I think is a step in the right direction.
Well, it certainly is, but I can tell you what the Republicans are going to say, what they said last year. money is free speech. And you can't limit money. You limit money, you live free speech. I'm not so sure I agree with that. I absolutely don't. But, hey, if they can get it through, God bless them. You got to start somewhere, but you're going to have fierce opposition.
Right, you got to start the conversation. You got to push it out there. Yes, and these are those things where people have to go. That's what we want. And you call your representative, and you get on the phone, and you write mail, and you write letters, and you hound them constantly. That's what they're there for.
And you mentioned Common Cause for decades. They've been out there preaching against the undue negative influence of money in politics. Good organization.
Anyway. So we'll take a quick break right back after this.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members. Did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. 2561.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. And now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., our correspondent from Talk Radio News Service, LaVisa Frost. LaVisa, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
What's going on in Washington tonight?
Well, we had the president is just returning from. He's been both in Pennsylvania. I'm sorry, and New York, but coming back now for late hour talks. As we know, he was not pleased with the negotiations with the House Speaker John Boehner and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. And he said yesterday that I will call them back until we get this done. And he's keeping true to his word. We're expecting a meeting to start in right about 15 minutes or so, and very soon that is, and we'll see what they can hammer out. We heard earlier from the president, they said we have a compromise. We reached a compromise, but there is no deal yet on the table, and we're not too many hours away from a federal shutdown, so they're going to try to get this somewhere done tonight and also continue tomorrow.
I'm sure whatever the compromise is, once they walk away from the table, Boehner will probably move the goalpost further to the extreme. So that no deal is possible, because I really believe the Republicans want this shutdown. What happens in the event of a shutdown? Is there any discussion of that?
Well, we heard already a couple of days ago, starting when White House Press Secretary Jay Carney was asked what is being taken, what steps are being taken. He said it would be irresponsible to not follow along those guidelines that do exist that start a week before a possible shutdown. And we have heard from several parts of the government that we have about 800 federal employees that would be furloughed. And I think for them, the worst thing, a lot of them would be deprived of their BlackBerries, which would be very scary for them, and instructed not to tweet. Locally here in Washington, they say trash collections would be suspended. And we are right in the middle of the Cherry Blossom Festival here that draws about 500,000 people in. And something that generates about $100 million for Washington every year, their annual festival will, in that case, actually be canceled, not because the parade itself is canceled, but because the Park Service, the National Park Service, obviously funded by government money, they can no longer honor the permit. So that will be a...
Heaven forbid we raise revenue.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, obviously... everything from national parks to Smithsonian's, and if you're waiting for an IRS refund that you get in the mail, an actual mail thing, that will also be something that will not work.
Well, we will see. Tomorrow is the deadline. What's going on with regard to Libya tonight?
Well, we got a letter earlier from Colonel Gaddafi to President Obama that he's urging him to end the NATO bombings in his country, and he made this appeal, like I said, in a letter. And we heard from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who said that this should not come as a surprise to Colonel Gaddafi, that we are not going to stop this. He must leave power, and he must stop abusing his people. So there's really, it was interesting that he appealed in a letter here, but it's really no change in the administration from Washington here. We also know that former congressman from Pennsylvania, Kurt Weldon, is there in the country right now. Expected, he was invited. Not really sure why that is. He was part of a delegation back in 2004. He was now invited.
I'm sure I know why. Arms sales.
Well, that is true. But he's been there for part of the day here, but he's yet to meet with Colonel Gaddafi. He's keeping him waiting. So that is sort of a reach out, and we'll see what happens there. But there has not been a meeting as of now.
As I understand, it was a rambling, incoherent letter, to be honest.
That is true. And I have to, it's one of those things that you have to wonder how those things actually come through the mail and how it works when you go through this. Obviously, you have to make sure that it's actually from him. So, but you're absolutely right. It was a rambling letter and nothing coherent, and they're not taking it that seriously, since it doesn't really show that Colonel Gaddafi wants to end this in a diplomatic way and leave power as the United States had asked.
Right. Lastly, Iraq. Secretary Gates had a statement today.
The Secretary Gates is actually in Iraq. This is probably his last visit as defense secretary, and he arrived late tonight. He's expected to be there for a couple of days and have several trips both to the north and a meeting with the American troops in Baghdad. So this is a big meeting for them in Iraq, and he gets to really talk to the troops, and as we said, it could be one of his last things, so he wants to make the most out of it.
Yeah, well, hopefully that if the government does shut down, all will be taken care of there, and the troops will be spared any hardship. They've got enough problems.
You absolutely, they need to just be taken care of.
Lavisa Frost, Talk Radio News Service, appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
And now to find out what's going on here in town, what do you got for us?
Well, Rick, the governor's finally come out with his proposal for the state workers, and he's proposing 4% cut in the state's largest employee union. Corbett is asking the state's largest employee union, which is the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Council 13, for a 4% pay cut in the first year of a three-year proposal. He proposes increases of 2% in each of the next 2 years. The average union employee is paid about $34,000 a year. Ashmere represents nearly 33,000 workers. In addition, there are numerous givebacks sought in health care contributions and other benefits. Changes to pensions are not on the table because these changes must be negotiated. AFSCME agreement usually provides the template for pacts with other unions. Contracts with AFSCME and 16 other state employee unions expire June 30th. Not good news for AFSCME Council 13 from the governor. Some pretty good news. Pennsylvania is seeking more federal money to speed up the travel time of passenger trains between Harrisburg and Philadelphia. Department of Transportation spokeswoman said Wednesday that the agency applied for a portion of the $2.4 billion that became available when the Florida's governor canceled a high-speed rail project in his state. PennDOT spokesman Aaron Walters said Pennsylvania is seeking about $248 million to speed up travel times in Amtrak's Keystone Corridor Eastern service by upgrading about 5 switches. The deadline to apply was Monday. She says a record 1.27 million passengers used the service during the 2009-2010 fiscal year. PennDOT's previous application for the $3.1 billion in federal high-speed rail money yielded less than $26 million to remove 3 cross vehicle crossing points in the same stretch of rail. So apparently we're going to be getting some money, and it should create some jobs, which is, without question in today's environment, Rick, a positive. A story that's a couple days old from Ohio. A statewide referendum looks like the next stage in a battle over Ohio collecting bargaining rights. Resistance, maybe even a statewide referendum, will continue in Ohio against the new law that strips away collective bargaining rights for public workers. The next step for SB5 in Ohio could be a citizens' referendum that would block the implementation of the law in the Buckeye State. If legislation is put on the ballot via a citizens' referendum, the law cannot go into effect. Opponents of the legislation now have 60 days to collect more than 230,000 signatures in order to get the measure on the ballot for November 2011. Another story, it's a couple days old. We covered this a little bit, but I want to get a little bit into detail on it. The main Republican state lawmakers are taking issue with the governor, who happens to be a Republican, Governor LePage. They call it government by disrespect. That's how six main Republican lawmakers are describing the actions of the fellow Republican Governor Paul LePage in recent days. LePage unilaterally moved an 11-panel mural from the state's Department of Labor that depicts the history of working people in Maine. In an op-ed piece in the Portland, Maine Press Herald, the lawmakers wrote this: "We should be focused like a laser on the agenda for the governor laid out, reducing our tax burden, getting rid of unnecessarily government regulation that stifles innovation and entrepreneurship, and putting into place thoughtful welfare reform. Instead, we find ourselves continually diverted, responding to yet another example of our chief executive picketing a personal fight not worth fighting. Government by disrespect should have no place in Augusta, and when it happens, we should all reject it." Meanwhile, a federal lawsuit was filed by the U.S. District Court seeking to confirm the mural's current location, ensuring that the artwork is adequately preserved and ultimately restored to the Department of Labor's lobby in Augusta, and that's good news. And that's my report, Rick.
All right, let's take a quick break. We're right back after this.
Defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well?
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything?
anything, that's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Quick email we got. And again, if you want to email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I just got to ask, the email says, if the threat of a government shutdown is part of the Republican agenda to divide and conquer Democrats by taking the attention away from the attacks on the working class going on at the state level. What little media attention there is now is focused on Washington. And, you know, to be honest, here's the reality. There hasn't been all that much national media covering what's going on in each state. The whole idea is you isolate those states. You know, Wisconsin was different because you had hundreds of thousands of people out. Wisconsin was different because you had all these people. Now, understand, when we were there, there was no CNN. There were no national news outlets. There was a local Fox affiliate. And speaking of the local Fox affiliate, I was watching this morning as they were talking about the election that went on last night, and we spent a lot of time looking at the returns and going through the whole scenario, which counties were behind, how the votes may go, because you know I'm insane, and that's kind of what I look at sometimes. But I was watching Fox News this morning, you know, just flipping through the channels, and they were using stock footage from the rallies back when we were there. And I was on Fox News because I have this yellow jacket, this big blue and yellow jacket.
Yeah, when we were walking around the Capitol, circling it.
When we were walking around the Capitol, it was snowing.
Imagine that.
There just a quick glimpse. I thought it was pretty interesting. Anyway, Bob writes, Rick, you mentioned Kat earlier tonight in regard to Colombian free trade. This was yesterday's story. It was in regards to Kat's CEO writing Governor Quinn a letter stating that after Illinois raised the corporate tax rate, he was being wined and dined by other states wanting Kat to relocate. And look, I don't doubt it. I mean, you know, the reality is Wisconsin, they ran a campaign. Come on over to us. And you were seeing the same kind of beggar thy neighbor mentality, which is why one of the main reasons that the kooky cabal over here who are putting this no rights at work agenda, one of the reasons they gave is that, well, you know, we're in the Northeast where it's all those union states. And if we were to go right to work, we could take all those jobs from those other states. That's their rationale. And again, it's that race to the bottom mentality. We could have all those low paying jobs. Minimum wage, baby. Minimum wage nation. And you know, what's good for the minimum wage is good for CEOs, bigger profits. And you look at the fact that the CEOs, according to a USA Today analysis are getting richer, while workers like you and me, we're seeing declining wages and even layoffs. USA Today, a recent analysis of data from the Governance Metrics International, showed that CEO pay jumped 27%. Near reaching pre-recession levels. So we're seeing the ones who caused a lot of the problems that we're in doing all right for themselves. And like I talked about yesterday and a little earlier, you had those top 25 hedge fund managers, nearly $1 billion apiece. Last year they did take $1 billion. This year about $850 million, and they paid 15% capital gains tax. And we say we're broke. You got 25 people, almost $1 billion apiece. We're not broke. We got revenue streams. And the reality is, like we said yesterday, you talk, if you're still buying this whole idea that handing all this money to the millionaires and billionaires is going to grow jobs, it ain't happened. We should be flushing jobs because we've given massive tax breaks away. Massive. GE, we've given massive tax breaks to. In fact, they pay zero tax. Not only that, but over the last several years, they've taken over $4 billion from us. Since 2002, they've cut 20% of their workforce here, closed 28 plants in the last 2 years. They've paid nothing. And, you know, like I said yesterday, Bernie Sanders came out with what I think is rational, saying, look, you folks need to chip in. ExxonMobil made $19 billion in profit in 2009, paid nothing in federal tax. The banks that were bailing out billions of dollars in profits to put into the hands of their investor class and paid nothing in taxes. So when I hear the Tea Party people saying, well, we're taxed enough already, I agree with you. I'm taxed enough already, too. I'm furious that we have massive corporations like this who are not only not paying anything, but they're getting some of our money in return. That's something to be all ripped off about. That's something to get fired up about and write your representatives and complain about. To me, it's really a simple equation. We don't have a spending problem. There are some areas where we could use resources better. Problem is we have a revenue problem. And if you go back and you look at the historical data of how this country prospered, it's by having A, controls on capital, and B, having a progressive tax code that said those with the biggest shoulders invest a little bit more. And we had a lot of loopholes. There were a lot of loopholes. Nobody paid that 92% tax rate during the Eisenhower years. Nobody did. What they did is they invested that money locally. They built schools. They built hospitals. They put their name on stuff. Vanderbilt University just didn't spring up because somebody named Vanderbilt thought it'd be a good idea to start a school. No, it was a way to hide money. So at the end of all of this, sane, rational tax code, and that's only going to happen when we wake up and say, the rich people need to help out a little bit. And every poll I see, Jake, and I was just looking at some of the polling for today, everybody, a large number, I think it was like 63% said that there should be no tax increases. And to me, when you look at that kind of stuff and you look at the polling that goes on, it's remarkable that we've been pushed down this path. The mainstream media, the Democrats are on board too, which is why I think somebody needs to grab a Democrat and smack him a couple of times. Say, look, hey, we got a revenue problem. There's too much money getting out of here. There are too many jobs leaving the country. Maybe we should close some of those loopholes. There's too much revenue leaving the state. Maybe we should close some of those loopholes. Just seems rational to me. Anyway, what can you do? Some of the polling numbers also that came out, state workers and their unions. I got to be honest, I'm looking at these numbers and I'm shocked. When asked, the ABC Washington Post poll, do you think workers in this country should or should not have a right to form unions to negotiate with employers on things like working conditions, pay, benefits, and pensions? 81% said that they should. Just 18 said should not. To me, that sends a clear message, but yet we've still got people like, I think I like Irwin's Mad Cow slip up. Well, maybe we're going to call Metcalf Mad Cow.
Does he know who Mad Cow is? I guess he does. Did you ever listen to the guy?
Who's Mad Cow?
Mad Cow. He has his own show.
Mad Cow?
Yes.
No. No.
But what's his name?
It's Man Cow.
Man Cow? Well, it's close.
Yeah,
close. The point I was going to make before I was so rudely interrupted, the conservatives and the right wing, I mean, they don't let the truth get in their way. They like to just punish unions. Your buddy was on radio again from the Ticky Tank. I mean, if you listen to him, he never misses a chance to nail unions, and he'll often say, well, the reason that they have low unionizations because people people realize they don't need them anymore. Well, that's just not true. That's just flat out wrong. And if you look at public opinion polls, it'll tell you that. It's not, there's low unionization rate because one, many of the unionized jobs went overseas, and two, the laws all too often are not only inadequate, but stacked in the favor of the employer. But then again, they don't, like I said, they don't let the facts get in the way, Rick.
Anyway, more talks. I haven't seen any reports on the talks between the president and the leader, so we're no budget as of yet. They're talking about the fact that it could affect up to 800,000 workers if we have a shutdown. You know, again, this is one of these things I don't see good for our economy, especially in times like this. That's a lot of tax revenue. That's a lot of spending that's not going on. But understand, what we've got is we've got a bunch of ideologues who are going to stick to their religion. They're going to stick to their blind faith ideology. And I'm hoping that people wake up and realize who's pushing this agenda. And it is the radical right. It is the people who are continually moving the goalposts down the road away from sane and rational thought. Anyway, yesterday the Government Accountability Office said a report that fiscal conditions of state and local governments will steadily decline through the year 2060. The reason they gave? Healthcare costs. We haven't done enough to reel them in. Now, they did say, although the sector's near-term fiscal picture has improved slightly since our March 2010 update, the economic downturn has created an unprecedented fiscal situation for states as revenues declined in tandem with the economy. So, look, everybody understands. All the reports are going in that direction. We have a revenue problem. And my question is, you know, we keep hearing the Republicans talk about spending problem. We got a spending problem. We got a spending problem. Because as Alice Rifkin said, in the debt commission hearing, you know, Americans, they got a taste for health care. Yeah. When they're sick, they like to go to the doctor. How dare they? When they fall and they break their legs, they want a cast. Can't they just get a couple of popsicle sticks and some tape like we used to do in the old days? They got a taste for health care. I mean, think about that for a second. When you're hearing all of this talk about spending cuts, ask where they're coming from. There are some things I think could use a little trimming around the edges, sure. But at the end of the day, when we're talking about taking money from Social Security, taking money from Medicare, taking money from Medicaid, that's the wrong direction. Taking money out of education, that is absolutely the wrong direction. Failing to invest in our infrastructure and in the ability of this country to compete globally. Again, very short-sighted, stupid. Just like here in the state. We have got a governor who has basically told you his priority is very short-term political gain at the expense of the future of this state. Now, understand, it's a political ploy. Their idea is they're going to throw this out there. They're going to get those kids all riled up so we can pit college kids and high school kids against poor people. And we can pit all of this group against that group, slice and dice, pitting people against each other. Or as the railroad magnate said, I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half. So they're going to throw a little funding into the scrum there. We're going to see Granny and the infant go at it. We're going to see, you know, one group go after another. Because that's how they like it. Instead of doing what is sane and rational, saying, you know what, we're sitting on a gold mine, and there are people extracting it out from under our feet and making a fortune off of it, maybe we should share in that. Instead of saying, no, let's share in that, they say, go ahead, take it. I know, with the belief that, you know what, once the pockets are full, once the treasure chest is full, once the coffers are full, maybe something will spill on the way out of town. That the rest of us can fight over. Because that's how it is, man. Again, declining revenues. That's our problem. At the end of it, and again, you know, we're pushing this idea that, you know, we need to have balanced budget amendments so that when we have economic crisis, we can't answer. We can't do anything. Anyway, I want to thank everybody for being here tonight. Our guests, our good friend Irwin Aronson, Senator Dalen Leach, and also our friend Harvey Kay. Thank you for being here. Also, I want to thank our engineer who slides the tubes and answers the phone. We'll see you tomorrow. It's coming from the
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the blood of sway. Imperial.